Well, no doubt about that one. General Sir Arthur Freeborn, Imperial General Staff.
Thus, by the 6,000 terrors of hell, are you anointed.
Good Lord.
So Hansen was right.
Well, that's Porter, isn't it?
Yes, the Right Honourable John Porter, MP. Minister with special responsibilities for our security services. Pity he didn't stick to collecting spiders.
Thus, by the nameless monsters of the lower depths, are you called?
A nod from him and a dozen civil service pensions go out of the window, including mine.
He could dissolve this department in 2 seconds flat.
So that's why you're working without official sanction.
He's not too difficult either. Lord Carradine, next to the church and the government, one of the biggest landowners in England.
Still owns half of London.
Seven lords of darkness, are you damned?
Professor Julian Keeley.
Not the Nobel Prize winner.
Yes, I'm sure it is. Expert in the fields of bacteriology, germ warfare and diseases of the blood.
Runs the Keeley Foundation here in London.
You'll hear a perspective which you won't find on the regular media, and it's going to happen right now.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 17th of March 2023 on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the glorious, well, I call it glorious anyway, Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which handily reminds you just before the show starts, so you can make sure you don't miss it. Well, I mean, you may be doing something much more important, of course, but at least it gives you a little ping to say, hey, the show's starting soon on a Friday, and we are also live on that app, so that's available from free from all good app stores, anything but Google, please. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its psychological warfare propaganda on all sorts of fronts. And I sort of patted myself a little bit on the back on Wednesday, having got onto a national phone-in to say, well, look, you know, the budget is a mess, the economy's a mess, but this is just part of a bigger mess, a wider mess. There's a migrant crisis, there's all sorts of other crises, we had a COVID crisis, and the solutions always seem to be make things worse. And so I talked a little bit about accelerationism and this idea that actually there are forces out there that are trying to make things worse. Welcome to also back to our Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and we're joined also in the studio by a one-to-one youth worker, Elle Williams, and a mum of one of the jailed Kill the Bill protesters, Heidi Gedge. Looking at the first part, we'll be obviously speaking to our guests, but also looking at the Bristol City Council One City Gathering, which took place this time last week, which was invite only. So we have officially invite only democracy here in Bristol, because this is the main policy making bodies for the city. So invite only democracy, welcome. That is the Labour Mayor Marvin Rees's big new thing. We'll also be talking to Martin about the budget and the banking collapse that we've seen over, well, various banks collapsing over the last few days, including, amazingly, Credit Suisse being bailed out. In part two, we'll be looking at the announcement just a couple of hours ago of Putin being indicted by the International Criminal Court. Maybe the Americans are going to take this as a reason that they're going to have to go and invade Russia to go and arrest Putin to bring him to court, or something equally ridiculous. Also about the drone attack this week over the Black Sea. And a special report investigation on evidence that depleted uranium shells might have been being used over in Ukraine, and that radiation now spreading across Europe. Quite worrying, that, but evidence from the department, UK Defence Department's own sensors are saying, oh, there's been a worrying increase in all this radiation. It looks like depleted uranium. Where could that be coming from? Well, it started just after the Ukraine war has started too. And so that is pretty much what we've got for you today, plus actually another piece with David Livingstone. One thing I'll say about, because we do kind of geopolitics and the occult here, so we're also looking at some of the hidden forces behind our politics. And I must say, well, I don't have to say anything. In fact, when I was working at Wiltshire Sound, we got back one Monday and some lady had left, a very nice lady, had left a message on our answer phone up in Swindon. Where she said, you don't have to say anything. Would you please stop saying, I have to say this or I have to say that? You don't have to say anything. And of course, she was right. So I won't say that again, listening to her. So let's kick off with L. Williams. L, can you just say something a little bit about, you know, your work and what you do and who you work for at the moment?
Yeah, so I'm a youth worker. I've been a youth worker in Bristol for the last 4 years. And I've worked with young people and children since I was a young person myself, so not to give my age away, but about 10 years ago. I currently work at Creative Youth Network, but I am here today to talk for my own personal opinion as a youth worker, but also as a Unison rep.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, well, that's right, because the trade unions, I think, are quite important, really. I mean, I certainly, as a member of the journalists union, feel that, you know, we as individuals in the profession don't want to be simply ordered around by our employers, because actually sometimes you find there's more respect for the job within the individuals doing it than those who are in charge. Quite often, I would think that probably applies to the police as well. So there's all sorts of areas where the, should we say, the congregation is better than the vicar, if we're allowed to say that. I'll probably not, but anyway, what do you make of your involvement with the union? Why the union?
So I think being part of a union is important for lots of different reasons. I think we're stronger together than we are on our own, and I think that comes, that's the bottom line, really. That's kind of fits in with my values. And I joined the union about 2 years ago, when we started to realise that the current place that I work for was coming to the end of a contract that had come from Bristol City Council, and worries had started around, you know, redundancies, what's the service going to look like moving forward, and yeah, joining the union felt like the right.
It was, yeah. I can promise you, I think for everybody, pretty much. I mean, we've had actually worth mentioning this week in Bristol, we've had on all local radio stations around the country at the BBC. A day's strike, because they're saying that the local radio is being completely decimated. In fact, sometimes, yeah, you know, the local radio, local BBC, is the only place you can go. Just phone their newsroom up and say, well, this is happening. And they quite often will just put you straight on the airwaves. Now, the national media in London's much more controlled, the BBC a bit less so. I'm not saying it's not controlled, because, yeah, having touched on some sensitive subjects there and not really managed to keep my job, I would also say that. But so tell us about where you work and what you do.
So I am based in North Bristol, but for the last 4 years I've worked in pretty much any area of Bristol other than South Bristol. A large part of my job is working with young people from the ages of 11 up to 19, sometimes up to 25 in certain situations. And I work really cover a broad kind of spectrum of things, mental health and well-being, sex and relationships, education, employment and training where needed, as well as just general support advice for the young people on my caseload. I also run a youth club session up in North Bristol and Southmead, and there's lots of other things that we get involved with as youth workers as well, stuff around youth voice and, yeah.
So for young people, do you find that they are a little bit uncomfortable about being given advice? I mean, they don't even like to take it from their parents, do they?
So, yeah, I think it depends where and when that advice is happening. So with referrals, so with my one-to-one work, that is a referral kind of based situation, so referrals will come in, so normally those young people will be wanting some sort of support and advice, and actually a lot of what my work is kind of getting that young person to kind of come to some decisions on their own with support rather than telling them what to do.
I mean, can you really offer them that much support other than kind words?
So I've had a lot of training. I'm trained in various different areas, so have a lot of knowledge around kind of low-level well-being techniques and support, give a lot of support to young people who might be questioning their sexuality or their gender, talking with young people around safe relationships, healthy relationships, and this is all stuff that's come through training and through experience. So the young people I work with do find the support, and actually just being there to listen, really invaluable.
Yeah, well, that's true. Someone who's not parents, who's professional. But, I mean, surely what youngsters nowadays need, and we had it when we were kids, I mean, I'm talking about back in the 1970s, opportunities. And now it seems that there's less opportunities for young people out there. Certainly those that where they can see themselves with a decent income, which is reliable into the future, and the possibility of starting to save. Now, this, a lot of this now for young people seems, you know, way out of reach.
Yeah, I think we definitely see that with the work. You can't really beat around the bush with young people, and actually we do engage them in kind of how they feel about, you know, their future and what's going on around them, and actually a lot of them are engaged in issues that they face or other people around them face, and really all we can do is kind of encourage them to have a voice, give them a platform where we can, and just empathise with them. Yeah.
Don't you think some young people would just see that as, well, this is, you know, we're sitting down, we're chatting to you, but actually you're not really changing anything. We're going to go out and keep behaving the same.
Some young people might feel like that, others won't. I think where youth work can differ and kind of offer a different angle, if you like, to maybe parents or teachers is a lot of the young people, in fact, all of the young people we work with, they don't want to be involved in our service, or if they don't want to come to youth club, they don't have to. And actually them being there and actually sitting down and having that conversation, to me, is them actually wanting to engage and them wanting to, you know, have these conversations.
So take us through what happens at a youth club today. You know, well, is it in the opening the evenings, I suppose, after school or something?
Yeah, so normally open in the evenings. And
what activities are there?
So at the current youth session that we're running up in Southmead, we've got a pool table, we've got an outside area where normally football or basketball's taking place. We'll have a kitchen where we've got young people involved in cooking for the group. Sometimes it's pizza, sometimes it's something a bit more exciting, depends on the young person that comes in and does it. We try and have some sort of creative element. So this week I've had a jewellery making kit out, which lots of different young people have got involved with, and PS4 as well. So that's what we've got at the moment. But actually,
PlayStation, yeah. Right, for the uninitiated, this is video games.
Yeah, so like FIFA, stuff like that. But actually, every youth club looks different. That's kind of what we've got up in Southmead at the moment. Some other youth clubs might have more sports-focused stuff, more creative-focused stuff.
Now, the background to all of this, Martin, I'm going to bring you in on this, really, because right at the beginning there, Elle is saying our contract is coming up and we were quite worried about our future. Now, this does suggest that a system has been set up whereby the plug can be pulled at any time from the youth service.
Well, the youth service used to be run by the council back in the day, and there were people unhappy with that. You know, the governments, Tory governments, for example, were unhappy with that, and perhaps it was a bit inflexible. So you've now moved to a situation where you subcontract to people who bid for the work.
Well, using the word inflexible, I mean, one of the flexibilities is you might close it.
Well, that's right. That's the downside of it, is that they can just turn around and say to an organisation which has been supplying whatever it is for however long it is, no, we're unhappy with this, we're going to get rid of all of you and bring in a completely new set of people. And that is the logic of subcontracting. We had some Japanese, when I used to work for the council, we had some Japanese people come over to visit from Kobe in Japan, and they've still got a system where it's a lifetime job to work for Kobe City Council as a youth worker, for example. You know, you leave school or university, you go to work for Kobe City Council as a youth worker, and that will be your job, and you won't be removed, and you're expected to, you know, there's a two-way thing about that. You know, so you've got the job security, but then on the other hand, you've got to be committed to doing it and all the rest of it. And the reason why they'd come over was because they're in Kobe in Japan, they were moving towards, why don't we do it more like they do in the West where they have subcontracting? And because they were unhappy with that, they came to see how we did it so that they could assess what they thought about it. And they made the obvious point, is it doesn't lead to a situation where everybody has to apply for their own job every 2 years. And of course the answer is yes, it does. You know, in Japan they don't have to bother with that. And that's what they came over here and said, well, look, you know, the problem with this, there's no continuity. And for young people, there's no continuity either. If everything's just changed on a whim, then there's a whole load of new people and a new way of doing it and all the rest of it.
Okay, so you're talking about voices for young people, but you yourself got a voice, didn't you, last week at the City Council?
Yeah.
So can you just tell us what was going on there? I think it was a cabinet, although the mayor, for some reason, wasn't there. I was expecting to see him, as he usually chairs the cabinet, apologies for absence from the mayor.
So I think the story is he was training for his half marathon. I don't know if that's true or not. And I don't know why he maybe couldn't train afterwards, after the cabinet meeting had finished, but there we go. So I went to cabinet last week on behalf of Unison members that work at Creative Youth Network, primarily to ask a question to the councillor, Asha Craig, about kind of what consultation had they actually done. Ask her, you know, what's going to happen to young people that currently get one-to-ones, because that's not in the plans moving forward. So Agenda 12 was all about future of youth services. So there was a future of youth service white paper that was authorised and passed through last week at cabinet. So that's kind of what we were talking about, and kind of some of the things that were coming up in there, and what that realistically means for the staff in the service, but also the service users, the young people themselves. So going to say my bit.
Yeah, so can you, in your own words, sum up the discussion? Because what they're basically saying is, we think that the youth service needs to be massively cut back, and you're saying, it shouldn't be. Maybe you could also explain why you think the whole one-to-one work is so important.
So So Bristol City Council essentially cutting the youth services budget, and they're moving from a contract system, which we've had for the last 5 years, and there was a similar subcontract situation in before that as well, which sat mainly with LPW, Learning Partnership West. And now what's going to happen moving forward is a grants-based system. Some of the reasons they've given for this are to prioritise grassroots organisations and to diversify youth services. But effectively, we're going from 1.42 million, which is where we're kind of at in the budget at the moment for youth services. And in the next 3 years, we're looking at around 825,000. That's what they've put in the white paper. I don't have the figures from last year, but with last year's budget figures for the youth service and kind of the 2025-26 budget, it's around 50% that's going to be cut from youth services, which obviously is a staggering amount. And the fact that we're moving to a grants-based system as well means that in some ways the pot could be divvied out to more organisations rather than it being a leading youth service that kind of delivers it and then has subcontractors attached to that larger contract. But whether it's a grant or a contract, the bottom line is that 50% of youth services is going to be cut.
Do you think they listen to you?
I would hope that they listen to me. Whether I think there's a difference between listening to what someone's saying and actually taking it in. And I think definitely the reaction that I got from the councillor last week, Asha Craig, was that the decisions are already made, really. The cabinet is just to have it all on public record. You know, we weren't going in there, as much as it would be lovely to go in there and, you know, ask questions and give statements and then say, right, okay, we're not going to authorise this. The decision was already made to authorise that white paper last week. you know, her response to me, at one point I think she did a bit of a laugh, and I just didn't find any of it funny, really.
No, well, it's not, is it? Actually, you know, this is our young people's future, right? Making sure that they're well looked at. I think the thing is, for me, looking at the whole situation for youngsters now, is it must be pretty disillusioning being a youngster, just looking at the employment prospects, job prospects, home prospects, family prospects, all those sort of things for the future, and then to have you know, the signposting guidance and some of the services put there forward by the government to help you through that process and face up to that disappearing. I mean, it's like a kind of double whammy, really.
Yeah, and I think one of the questions that was asked by another person in the service was, is this the message that we want to give to young people? You know, they some of the kind of stats that are coming out of the back of the pandemic is they're one of the most disproportionately affected groups of people in society from the pandemic. A lot of them were isolated, a lot of them weren't, you know, at school, and really from what I've experienced working with young people at the time was a lot of them were getting sent the same homework every week. They weren't actually learning anything, and you know, all you have to do is have a scroll on TikTok or whatever as a young person and just see what the message is from the rest of the world on kind of their future. So this is just another blow, really. And you know, I've had a lot of emotions. Some of them have been anger, some of them have been kind of confusion, but what kind of stands out to me amongst them all, really, is I'm just really sad for the young people, because I think we you know, the service that we offer at the moment is we struggle as it is. We struggle with signposting when actually the threshold of the needs for those young people that we're getting referrals for are, you know, way above our service. You know, people that need specialist support around mental health, or young people that are at risk of exploitation or already, you know, within the grooming, you know, are already being groomed by gangs. And for some services, there's a 2-year wait. There's a 1-year wait. And, you know, that conversation is difficult enough as it is. But, you know, with the current decisions by Bristol City Council, those conversations won't even be happening at all, because we won't be there to deliver that one-to-one service. And we, Creative Youth Network yesterday closed referrals, so referrals are now closed, and you know, there's a plan for them to work through the waiting list that we do have. But I think schools and parents and staff over the next few weeks are going to start to learn of the news that the one-to-one offer that we currently have won't be there anymore. And I can't imagine that, yeah, the wider community are going to have any positive things to say about it.
So Creative Youth Network's Chief Executive Mark Coates told the council meeting, which you were at, on Tuesday, March the 7th, that the city and his organisation had an outstanding youth service, as officially recognised by the National Youth Agency. But as a result of tonight's decision, he said, that service will be dismantled and replaced by something very different and much smaller scale. The new grants will not fund any one-to-one support for young people. Funding is, of course, ridiculously tight, and we fully accept the one-to-one support has to reduce, but to discontinue it entirely feels profoundly wrong. Those who need it are the most vulnerable young people in the city, and their service is about to be discontinued. From one-to-one, our one-to-one caseload is a significant number of often very complex safeguarding cases for which Creative Youth Network is very often the lead agency. There's a real risk of inadequate safeguarding if you do not have adequately focused support on the most vulnerable young people. What is this term safeguarding, what does that really refer to?
So I think what Mark's referring to there is a lot of the work that happens in these one-to-ones. And sometimes, you know, so we have our one-to-one service, which is, like I've said, you refer into that. So we have social workers referring, teachers referring, young people can self-refer, a lot of parents refer into that service. But actually, as well as that, there's a lot of one-to-one work which exists outside and around our youth work sessions as well. On Monday, I had a safeguarding incident with a young person who was in a mental health crisis, and actually being able to both work in a youth group session and have a one-to-one service on offer allows me to not only deal with that young person in that crisis at the time, but also to be able to have a continuity of the same worker, hopefully, or at least somebody that's, you know, within the same organisation, pick that young person up and, you know, potentially offer them some extended one-to-one support there. Without having that, some of the complex kind of situations we're seeing with young people at the moment, it's really hard to deal with them on the spot in a youth session. And so I think with regards to safeguarding, I think one thing that I definitely think about a lot and have been thinking about a lot at the moment is young people that are at risk of exploitation. So that might be criminal exploitation, or that might be criminal sexual exploitation, and that is rife in Bristol. We're just off the M4. You guys have probably heard of County Lines, and that situation is getting worse. The pandemic has exacerbated it, actually. Even though young people should have been at home, there wasn't people looking out for them. They weren't at school, they weren't necessarily going to the regular youth clubs because they were closed, because people weren't allowed out. And actually, those vulnerable young people who maybe didn't have the right support at home were left open, vulnerable to people, you know, that, you know, trying to groom them into, you know, horrible situations. So I think what we're seeing and what I'm kind of sensing with those young people in particular is that the police are going to start dealing with those situations. Whether that's the right thing to do or not, I don't know.
Well, I'd say no.
Yeah, I think preventative youth work is, preventative, any preventative support that we can offer young people surely is the best way to go about it than rather dealing with the issue once it's happened.
Well, to use a crude analogy, it's a bit like surgery. You know, if you can prevent someone getting cancer in the first place, then they won't have to go in and get surgery at all. So also just looking at the another news story which is popped up today here in Bristol, a raft of measures to tackle knife crime has been agreed overwhelmingly by Bristol City Council. More than £650,000 will be spent, not on the original proposal in the Green Party's motion, which is to spend that money on grassroots groups in order to be able to work closely with youngsters, particularly the sort of youngsters we were talking about who are being sucked into organised crime. But no, installing CCTV on local authority land over the next 2 years. So this was a motion which was tabled at a meeting of full council on Tuesday this week by Councillor Mohammed Makawi. In fact, he used to have the programme after us at Bristol Community Radio every Friday, and he's now a Green councillor. His friend Adam Ali Ibrahim was fatally stabbed in Castle Park on the 31st of January this year, and Labour made several changes to the proposals he put forward, which the Greens initially opposed before the Chamber voted in favour, with just one Green member against. So speaking afterwards, Councillor McCarvey said, "I'm delighted my motion passed tonight. Send a clear message Bristol can and will do to more to tackle knife crime. But importantly, its causes, by taking simple steps like providing emergency bleed kits and training to nighttime venues, fixing blind spots and providing more lighting and CCTV, we can save lives." But he says, also goes on to say, you know, he feels that he's very disappointed that the important points of the motion, references to the council's getting its drugs strategy right, addressing the stigma of neurodiversity, whatever that is. Do you know what that is? Neurodiversity.
Neurodiversity. So neurodiverse people are people that have things like autism, ADHD.
Oh, right. Okay. Thanks. And crucially, commitment to improving lighting in dark areas, McCarvey said. So what's happened is Bristol City Council's Labour, they're not actually the ruling Labour group, but we've got a mayor who's Labour. In fact, the Greens are the biggest group now, have had really the guts of their motion taken out by Labour, and that's the one that passed. That is to say that this money for the CCTV, the £650,000, was in the budget anyway and had been given to them by central government. So they've said that actually, rather than give money to the sort of groups which might stop knife crime in the first place, what we're going to do is we're going to put a load of cameras up so we can watch it taking place, effectively. So that's why Councillor McCarvey, and I spoke to him earlier on, has been annoyed about this. One of the other contributors to the debate this week at Bristol City Council was Green Councillor Annie Stafford Townsend, and she wasn't happy about the way that the motion had been hijacked either.
It's disappointing and problematic to remove the welfare assisted drug approach, as the two issues are very closely linked. But again, we understand that the administration is doing everything that they can within current legislation. I think it's very important, actually, to, when it comes to neurodiversity and special educational needs, that we name the issue in order to tackle it. We can't pretend it's not a thing that's there. And it's disappointing that whilst lighting will become more energy efficient, that the commitment to improve lighting in known dark areas has been removed. It's also disappointing that the local knowledge of councillors is being removed from the promotion to feed into local hotspots and to work collaboratively together, because we have to work collaboratively together in order to make the best outcomes for our city and our residents and for everybody coming and being born and growing up in the future years, because the years aren't going to get any easier. Councillors are already excluded from multi-agency meetings, and yeah, that hasn't always been the case. When I was a councillor before, I was able to go to those. And the exclusion of anybody with skills or knowledge is detrimental to good outcomes. So we have to start working together. The opportunity was to do that and talk to us and have an altered motion tonight, but that's not where we are. And therefore, as a result, we feel that this amendment weakens the original motion and we will not be supporting it.
So that's Councillor Annie Stafford-Townsend here in Bristol trying to put a brave face on it, but actually, what seems to have happened, Martin, is this motion has been really denuded, and rather than tackling the causes of knife crime, there now seems to be a much better organisation up there to watch it taking place.
So did the Green motion, did the Greens vote for the motion in the end?
I think so.
So they did?
With one that didn't. So the motion passed, but yeah. But it was an amended motion to take out aspects like, for example, better improved lighting, working with councillors to prioritise with the police specific areas in their wards where knife crime had been taking place, stopping the exclusion of councillors from meetings with the police and things like that.
Well, I mean, obviously, this comes back to the whole mayoral system. Because, you know, the mayoral system as originally conceived, and if you remember, George Ferguson was very much in favour of this when he was the mayor, is that the mayor just decides everything and the councillors really can be excluded. And of course, there was a referendum about that, and that's not going to happen in the future. There's going to be, you know, we're going to go back to a committee-style system. And of course, when we get to that system, somebody like, I mean, the Greens are the biggest party on the council now. They will probably run the council, possibly on their own or in an alliance with others, and they wouldn't be excluded from it because they couldn't be. But at the moment, we're still under the old mayoral system, and we're no doubt going to come on to discuss this
later on, but it's
up to them to decide. They just decide and that's it.
There's a wider aspect here. It's the council seems to prefer to invest in technology rather than people.
Yeah. And I think that is an example. A bit. I mean, they could have chosen. I mean, you know, it's up to Marvin. He could decide whatever he wants to do. If he wanted to invest in people and not technology.
Well, they might well argue. Well, actually, we had a load of money for CCTV anyway from central government.
Well, I mean, I don't. You see, if you've got central government money which has been earmarked already for something, then you can't spend it on something else anyway. So I don't. You know, I don't know the detail here. So it's hard to. I mean, the fundamental problem is the mayoral setup. And that's going to change, and when it does change, you know, councillors will be included because that's the way it works if you're going to have a council, a committee system on the council.
Okay, before we wrap up talking about the youth service, we might well talk about it more in a minute, but there is something going on here, isn't there? The way that all these services since 2008, really, Martin, have moved away from council, I mentioned this earlier, to a kind of hived off, run by the charitable, not-for-profit sector, and now basically it looks like that all the rug is being pulled out from underneath that. So rather than try and pull the rug out from underneath the local authority services, these services have been hived out, right, to other organisations, and now the money's being slowly but surely pulled away.
Well, there are two issues there. One is what we were talking about earlier, whether things should be done directly by the council or by other organisations who subcontract to the council. And the other fundamental problem is the lack of money. Since 2008, the central government has cut the money for local authorities and lots of other things, and that's why we haven't got any money for the things that we're talking about. But, of course, it wasn't necessarily a very good idea. when George Osborne was the Chancellor, he carried on cutting the budget for local authorities and other things, and the effect of that was actually to push the economy down and lose the country's AAA credit rating. And of course we saw with the mini-budget of Kwasi Kwarteng that they managed to lose £30 billion in a week, but just through sheer incompetence. And then we wonder why we've got no money for things.
How did they lose that £30 billion then?
Well, because they had to bail out the pension system because of the fact that the pound was under threat and the pension funds were about to go down unless they bailed it out. So the Bank of England had to step in and bail it out. Now, that just suggests that, I mean, even in a global crisis, there are stupid things you can do. Austerity isn't necessarily the answer to any of these problems. The money that's going to be pulled out of local communities here by the reduction in your budget is money that won't be spent into the local community. You know, it's not just a question of we'd like to have all these things. The fact is that money won't be there, and therefore, you know, the money won't circulate around. And that is actually not necessarily terribly smart. The idea that if you've got a problem, all you need to do is cut public expenditure is just silly. It just depends, doesn't it? If we're going to have a war with Russia, for example, which we may discuss later, then no doubt there'll have to be rationing and increases in public expenditure and all sorts. You know, think about World War II. They didn't
scrimp and save. Where would they get the money for it?
Well, there's a magic money tree. Theresa May told us there wasn't one, but clearly there is. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to get through the pandemic. And, of course, people can realise that. Because of the pandemic, people saw, well, hang on a minute, they can... Rishi Sunak basically nationalised the whole economy for 2 years. And the sky didn't fall in. It's perfectly feasible to do. And in many ways, it's actually possibly quite a sensible thing to do. But, of course, we're then moving to why we have got... What is important in our society? Is young people's future, or is it something else?
So there really is
bankers' bonuses.
There really is a magic money tree.
Well, there is to a point.
There must be, though.
To a point.
I think, you know, a lot of conversations that I've had with other members this week who are, you know, members that in the youth service as well, is, you know, we're seeing articles coming out all the time. I mean, I read an article in Bristol 24/7 yesterday around this supposed underground that Bristol are going to have. And the plans alone for that to, I think it's Bristol City Council and Weka, kind of even to look at the plans of how that would work, somewhere in the mark of £13 million. I mean, Bristol Beacon, there's questions now being raised around that overspenditure. And actually, one thing that we did bring up last week in Cabinet around this Bristol Super Youth Club, Super Youth Zone, that Marvin's very happy about, and, you know, as I said, will bring, you know, great things to Bristol, but, you know, completely ignoring the fact that it's in South Bristol, so actually a lot of young people won't be able to access it. There's issues with young people crossing, you know, borders in their own areas, never mind, you know, young people going from North Bristol or East Central down into South, young people that are in gangs, stuff like that. And, you know, Bristol City Council are giving £400,000 to that venture. I would love to know why there's money for these things like buildings, when we've got existing buildings. In South Mead, there's a youth club that's going to be knocked down, so there's an extra bit of car park for Aldi. That's a perfectly good building. I've run youth sessions in there. It's not falling down, but that's now going to be knocked down for Aldi. When now there's going to be a new super youth centre built, and actually part of a nature reserve in Hartcliffe Way. So I really struggle to know how there isn't money for youth services, but there is money for other stuff.
Well, I mean, this just sounds as if the council abusing their power, because of course they will almost certainly own that land that Aldi are now using. They're maybe selling it to Aldi or giving them a long lease or whatever. And if they're building on a nature reserve, then they're giving themselves planning permission to do that.
Absolutely.
So they are really pushing things as much as they can in order to... But the thing is, whose agenda are they actually working to? It doesn't seem to be the people's very much. Anyway, we're also joined by a very patient Heidi Gedge here. Hi, hello, Heidi. Nice to welcome you to the studio, because I mean, this is a story which has been, we've touched on quite a few times here over the last couple of years, but particularly now we're seeing the sentencing of many of the individuals involved in this Kill the Bill. Well, I don't like really to call it a riot, because it was a peaceful protest. It did turn violent when the police decided they were going to move everybody, and there are echoes of the when I were a lad, the Criminal Justice Act march in the 1990s against Margaret Thatcher, where the police simply drove a vehicle into the crowd and started a fight like that. But anyway, can you just tell us a little bit about you know, your own personal family situation with this?
Yes, my daughter, Mariella Gedge Rogers, she went down to the protest, as it wasn't a riot. It was the peaceful protest, as you said. And she, when the procession moved down outside Bridewell, and then there was all the influx of the police all ploughing in and starting attacking everybody, she was absolutely amazed and disgusted about what she could see. People getting hit, people getting sprayed, people down on the floor, and she sort of tried to stand up to the police, and she got through the line at one stage, and herself, she was actually caught by three police officers and pinned to the ground, and had her head in the gutter, fearing for her life. And she actually, you know, had thoughts of George Floyd at the time, who died at the hands of the police. And she was, while that was happening, she was just, well, obviously scared for her life. But when they finally did let her go, they just let her go straight back into the crowd, whereupon she was targeted after that moment. And obviously they followed her around afterwards.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. Let me just stop you, because it doesn't sound that those officers at the time thought that she'd actually committed any offence if they just let her go, because they did have the facilities there to take people into custody.
Exactly. And I've made a complaint to the police commission about that, because not only was it she had excessive force against her, then I really believe it was entrapment. And also, I think there was a racist element there as well, because my daughter being a woman of colour. And afterwards, like I say, they followed her around. She did clash with the police, which has been seen on the social media, on the mainstream media, with her and her skateboard, which is a really awful portrayal of her, because the police officers actually, at the time, he wasn't hurt. And she spoke to him afterwards. And then she did carry on, did a couple of other things that were a bit silly, smashing some windows and stuff. But, I mean, what she did, first of all, she was completely traumatised by her encounter with the police. And the fact that she actually was only at the protest until 7:30. So when she was actually... well, she gave herself in the end, because her face was on the television with all the other people.
That's right. They had a load of mugshots, didn't they, saying, here are all these dangerous people. Yeah. Please dob them in.
Exactly. They were portrayed like dangerous criminals and terrorists. So when she did finally give herself in, you know, she was actually only going to be charged on a violent disorder, which, you know, she was advised to plead guilty to because of what went on during the protest. But which later, when she actually got into court, from interference from the Home Office through the CPS, it was changed, and the sentence was changed to riot. And then she wasn't just facing possibly a suspended sentence or, you know, a few months in prison if she did get fined guilty for violent disorder, but the minimum of 6 years and 3 months if she was found guilty for a riot. I mean, what she did get in the end was 5 years, 5.5 years in prison for riot.
Well, I mean, can you just explain what happened with the skateboard? Because that sounds, you know, I mean, if a skateboard could be used as a shield and it could be used as a weapon, couldn't it?
Well, yeah, she had the skateboard. She got it back from the police after, like I say, they let her go. And she clashed with the skateboard. I mean, it says in the news, it said that she hit over the head of this police officer. Well, I mean, this police officer, he was there, and he had a shield, he had a helmet, he had his boots on. And like I say, he wasn't hurt. And she did go up to him afterwards and speak to him.
Right. So it does seem like a long time. I wonder, I mean, how many others are there in a similar situation to Mariella that have faced quite extraordinary long sentences? Because, I mean, it sounds to me as if the goalposts have been shifting through this court case. So it starts off as one thing and suddenly it sprung on you. And potentially some of these cases, including your daughter's, they may be really an attempt to send a message out to the general public rather than to actually administer justice.
Yes, that's exactly what happened. I mean, she was totally made an example of, you know, victimised, you know, political prisoner, you know, do not riot. This is what's going to happen. But with the first wave of cases, they pleaded guilty in the beginning for riot because they were advised to do that, because the problem is there aren't really enough sort of criminal justice solicitors and who actually can deal with this sort of case. So when it came to Mariella and the few other people around her time, they were all still facing the riot charge.
They'd been advised to plead guilty to that. Is this some kind of plea? Because, I mean, that's, like you say, it's potentially a long time in prison. Mm. I mean, you have to actually ultimately for yourself decide, do I want to plead guilty to this? Because that could mean I do 7 years in prison.
Well, yeah. I mean, the first lot of people who were advised to plead guilty, they were told, oh, well, if you get found guilty, your sentence will be shorter. But then when it came to Mariella, she pleaded not guilty and subsequently got found guilty. But now what's happening after the next lot of cases have come up, because it's taken such a long time, over 2 years, that they're actually now offering the next few defendants an option. They've dropped the riot charge. They've said, OK, we're going to drop the riot charge now if you just plead guilty to violent disorder or affray or other things like that. And they've been given a choice. So they're not going to get a fair trial, but they're not going to get 5.5 years in prison. So they're all getting now between 8 months suspended and 27 months custodial sentence. And so, you know, why on earth can't other people be offered the same who have been gone to prison for 5.5 years, 5 years, 10 months? You know, they should all have been given the same choice.
Well, Martin, it sounds to me like the Bristol Crown Court, the criminal justice system in this city, is making it up as they go along.
Yeah, and I think probably there was pressure from the Home Office, wasn't there?
Yeah.
They were trying to make an example, as you say. I mean, I used to live in Brixton in the 1980s, and I was there when both riots took place. And what your daughter did is pretty small beer compared to proper rioting. Proper rioting, you're not usually face-to-face with the police. You've usually got the police well back because they're having things thrown at them. And it's quite different. Demonstrations which turn into I've been on lots of picket lines, demonstrations which turn into sort of, you know, pushing and shoving and people being pushed over, they're not the same as rioting. And in any case, I would argue that what she's done there is criminal damage, possibly, and possibly ABH or something like that. I mean, that's what.
Well, apparently the policeman wasn't injured.
Well, therefore, you might say that you could just drop that then.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? I mean, there's a difference of approach here.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a Judge Jeffreys type.
Well, it is. And I think, yes, some things happened that night which people weren't happy about, who were watching on the television or whatever. These things do happen, but then there's got to be some kind of... I mean, I think that's totally disproportionate. Mm. It's absurd.
Right, it sounds to me a bit like a miscarriage of justice. I think we should also see something about this protest, what it was about. The Kill the Bill Act. I mean, we actually had big protests in London over the Criminal Justice Act back in the 1990s. Kill the Bill, it was called, you know, the Kill the Criminal Justice Bill. And they were very successful. Tens of thousands of people, maybe even hundreds or 200,000 people marching in London, because the what was going on with that was that they were introducing this new law of criminalising trespass. So the rave scene was completely threatened by that. The free party scene was being threatened by there were, and there was also squatting, that sort of encampments by travellers were being threatened by that bill, which was actually written, as I remember speaking to the guy himself, written by the chief lawyer of the Country Landowners Association. He'd written that part of the law. And the Conservatives just cut it and pasted it into the law. So there is a political aspect to this Priti Patel bill, Martin, that's now law, isn't it? Which is specifically, I mean, there's two main parts of it. One is trying to stop protests, saying that protests can only be a certain length of time and have to be arranged with the police, and also that they mustn't be more than a certain number of decibels. And then there's also this really pernicious aspect of seizing the homes of travellers if a landowner phones up the police.
Yeah, well, I mean, the police themselves have put no pressure on the government to bring in this law. As far as they were concerned, the laws they have are absolutely adequate to deal with anything that they have to deal with.
Well, I'm saying there's a political aspect to
Priti Patel. That's what I mean about the political aspect. Priti Patel wanted to bring in the law as a way of throwing red meat to her own potential supporters as Prime Minister. Don't think what's going through her mind, yeah? She wants to be Prime Minister. And to be Prime Minister, you need the votes of the 80,000 people who are members of the Conservative Party. And if she can be seen to be tough by throwing people like your daughter into prison for 5 years, that's positive from her point of view. So that's underlying all of that. And of course, the police themselves have never asked for these powers. And of course, the police are not necessarily entirely... I mean, the Bristol police in general, I find pretty good compared to the Met, where I lived in London for 16 years. They were a different kettle of fish. The Met today have just had an excoriating report on their behaviour.
I think maybe, Heidi, you could say a bit more about the role of the Crown Prosecution Service. This is, of course, Keir Starmer's old service. This is the service which has been behind the prosecution of Julian Assange. So they have endorsed that. They've also, when Starmer was Chief Crown Prosecutor, they were also the people that put in the bin the evidence that Surrey Police twice presented to them about Jimmy Savile being a paedophile. So this Crown Prosecution Service, what was their role in your daughter's case?
Well, their role was just, I guess, with all the cases, to change the sentence, because the police didn't regard the night as a riot. It was the CPS who came in and said, okay, this is now a riot, and we're going to charge everybody on this sentence.
I mean, you talked about, you know, your daughter being a political prisoner. Do you really believe that?
Absolutely. It's not from the police side. You know, she would have been, well, not okay to have pleaded for, you know, gone to prison on another charge. But okay, she did a couple of things there. But you know, she was prepared to do, I mean, community service. You know, she was, when she went to court, she was really empathetic with the police on that night. You know, and she was so truthful, and it was the actual people in court, the police all coming in there, and they were talking about the whole event that went on till 2 o'clock in the morning, everything that happened, and she wasn't even there.
Well, I mean, anyone that can remember it, this is almost exactly 2 years ago now, the TV pictures flash all the way around the world, didn't they? All around the world, of burning police cars in Bristol city centre. And I think many people will remember that. And obviously anyone that looking on the TV will think, crikey, you know, I wonder if any police were in there at the time. Actually, the fact was that the police a few days later, maybe a week or so later, had to belatedly admit that they had lied about the police injuries.
Yes, that's right. Because they, first of all, trying to drag in all the media by saying, oh, yeah, we've had 60-odd police officers, broken bones and everything. And, yeah, it was a complete lie. And there was hundreds of protesters injured on that night, 62 fairly seriously. I mean, my daughter was one of them. And when she went to court, Judge Patrick, who's been residing over most of these, actually just said, oh, it's just a scratch. You know, not even thinking about the mental side either. And then he said to her at the end of her trial, He said, well, I'm not going to give you a sentence that's going to damage you or your mental health or anything, you know. And then he just said, oh, well, you have 5.5 years.
Sounds like he's on a bit of a power trip, this judge, and it doesn't sound like a good thing to have judges that are like that sitting on Crown Court hearings. Martin, I mean, there's definitely a political aspect to this, isn't there?
Absolutely.
I mean, and particularly with the police. I mean, this is one of the things that bothers me about this, especially when a story goes right around the world, a sensational story. We know how much the media loves sensational stories. And of course, with that is coming all this information about all these police officers injured. The story where they retract and they say, actually, there weren't all these police officers injured, or the injuries were much less, and we exaggerated and we lied. That story hardly goes anywhere, and the rest of the world never sees that, do they? In fact, the national press probably never see it.
No. Yes, I mean, I'm really sorry to hear this, because it's totally unfair. But it reminds me of what happened in the Tesco confrontation some years ago just up the road here, where local people were very unhappy about Tesco opening a store. Mm-hmm. Lots of the local shops were opposed to it, and you know, they organized a campaign. They got a petition up. They also put when Tesco opened the store, they put a picket line on the store, had 6 people peacefully saying to people, don't go in there, the community doesn't want Tesco. And that was working. Tesco, you know, people won't generally cross a picket line like that, so they didn't. And then on the evening of, I think it was the royal wedding, everybody was on holiday, so everybody was drinking till late, all on the streets, just hanging around, nothing much happening. Everybody was just milling around like they would normally do of a sunny evening. And then about 9 p.m, 3 different police forces turned up. One from Devon and Cornwall, one from Wales, and I think there was a third one. And in actual fact, they did a freedom of information request. That was 12 different police forces. And what the police claimed was that there had been a petrol bomb that was being made in the squat telepathic heights up the road here. And when we got to the bottom of and eventually 2 young lads were charged with making a petrol bomb, which they denied, although they pleaded guilty because they were already in trouble. And so the whole thing was they brought these people in from outside, and there was no problem
the
at
police,
all. The police.
About, yeah.
And then everybody just stood up to them and said, we're not having, you know, just leave our community. So there was no riot. It was just the police versus a large group of people saying, go away. You know, you shouldn't be here. And of course, this whole thing was a manipulation, because the peaceful protest was being successful. And what people in the government wanted was to have a confrontation in Bristol. Because Bristol has got a reputation for being a protest city. Yeah.
Yep.
And of course, what they want that to be seen as is as violent disorder. They're actually quite keen for that to be the case. So the Welsh police in particular had been fired up by their officers to believe, we're going to St. Paul's, you know, goodness knows what it's going to be like. And they were all fired up. They were all armed up as well. Well, they didn't turn up in. And the Labour MP, Kerry McCarthy, it wasn't actually part of her constituency, but she found out what was happening. She went down with her parliamentary researcher, a guy called, I've forgotten his name now. Anyway, but what happened, they turned up to watch, and a Welsh riot police walked straight over to him and whacked him over the head with a riot baton, and he said, ow, that hurt, and I'm actually a full-time worker for the Labour Party, and this is my MP standing next to me. And of course, at 3 o'clock in the morning, they finally gave up and went away.
They weren't expecting that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of local police in Bristol weren't very happy about it, because they've done quite a lot of work in St. Paul's over the years, and potentially this could have turned into a riot because of their behaviour. And of course, in the August of that year, there was nationwide rioting after the killing of Duggan. And I thought that was incredibly irresponsible. Yeah. Of whoever was behind that, because it didn't turn into a big fight, but it might have done. And of course, that could have then, I mean, I remember the riots in 1981 and 1985. You know, this sort of thing can just take, you know, people with social media, they can go, oh, right, look at this, we're all going out for a fight. And I think it's playing with fire, all of this. I mean, for example, in your daughter's case, if you're going to get 5 years for doing what she did, you might as well throw a petrol bomb.
Yeah.
You might as well, mightn't you?
Well, exactly. It was going back to the riots in Bristol in 1981, when everybody was up in court. The whole lot of them, all 15 of them, were all acquitted of riot, and that went
because the riot charge is actually archaic.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's something from the 19th century.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be on the statute book.
It should
not. If you carry out an act of violence, that should be specified, not just a riot.
Yeah, which is what we're trying to overturn, and we need to change the narrative.
Are you appealing?
Well, we tried to appeal, but because there was no new evidence, they said we didn't have a case, but we are talking to solicitors at some different angles, and also with the police complaint. They've taken so far about, I don't know, 8 months to compile the report. So when that finally comes in, the solicitors will be having a look at that too.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's pretty shocking that this kind of thing is going on. I mean, we've heard in great detail about Mariella. What about the others involved? Are there others that have had long sentences like that? I mean, it does sound, I mean, what you're saying is if the authorities have realised actually this is, some of these sentences are a bit over the top, we better rein it back a bit, which does sound to me as if they're just, like I said, making it up as they go along.
They are. What happened, basically, so there was Mariella and there was about three or four other cases, well, maybe five cases, that all got done with the riot and they all got up to 5 years and 10 months. And then what started to happen, there was one person was acquitted and then a couple had a hung jury. And the CPS must be thinking, hang on a minute, what's going on here? The tide is changing. And then they started to think, well, let's just hurry them all up, drop the riot charge, get them on something, and then we can, you know, get this all finished with. That's what it looks like to me.
What's your own view on this act, this, I think it's police crime court sentencing?
Well, it's terrible. You know, it's totally taken away people's rights. I mean, people that were there that day to protest for their, you know, for their fundamental right to protest, and, of course, a number of other aspects. And, I went along to one of them myself, because I didn't believe it should be. I mean, if the police can act like that before they had any powers, what the hell are they going to be like? And, you know, afterwards.
Actually, Martin, you know, in a great tradition, in a way, it's a duty to go and protest laws like this.
It is. It is indeed. And, of course, the politics of it stink. As I say earlier, Priti Patel wanted to be Prime Minister. That's what the main thing in her mind was. And that's why she brought it forward in the first place. I mean, years ago, we had a protest in central Bristol, a Stop the War protest, because British Aerospace produced drones and they decided to have a drone conference right in the centre of Bristol, which we found out about. So we went and protested. And we made an absolute racket because we had a punk band, a sound system, everybody's banging pots and pans. We weren't doing anything violent, it's been very noisy. And of course they couldn't have their little meeting. And the police, in that case, were extremely fair and reasonable. They said, and they were saying, well, can't you just shut them up? And they said, well, no, we can't. There's no law that says that they can't make a noise. So they had to close the meeting. And then I was on ITV. Remember, I phoned you and the ITV sent people down. And I was on ITV with China. And we said, you know, good riddance to these people. They shouldn't have had this they shouldn't have had this thing here. But the police behaved responsibly, in my view. Mm. Just as they did on the day of the removal of the Colston statue. And in actual fact, Bristol police, in general, have a more permissive attitude towards protest than you find in other parts of the country, because it's part of the tradition in Bristol. Then it doesn't have to be a riot. No. There's no reason for it to be a riot, is there? If everybody's behaved sensibly, then we can have a protest and all the rest of it.
I'd like to hear from you, Al, what you make of this, because there must be many young people that are looking at these unjust laws coming down the pipeline and thinking, well, I want no part of this. And they're feeling alienated.
Yeah, so we last year in Creative Youth Network's main space, which is the old fire station, so opposite Bridewell, so it was right in the midst of everything that was going on.
Was the old police station in there, wasn't it? The other side was an old fire station, and the other end was an old police station.
Yeah, stuff like that. So we put exhibitions in there a lot of young artists that. All sorts of different stuff comes out. And we had a young artist response to the Kill the Bill protests. And actually, and the bill itself, and young people overwhelmingly are in favour of protests. I mean, there's protests all the time in Bristol. You know, we had for a long time, we had the Friday protest of all the school children, off the back of kind of Greta Thunberg's kind of environmental fight. And, you know, protest and having a voice is it's a fundamental right, like you say. And I think, again, you know, young people, it's just another thing that they're seeing, you know, that they're being told what to do. A lot of conversations that I've had with young people is that, you know, there was conversations at the time when all this came out, and you know, it's quite an exciting, you know, situation seeing, you know, things on the news and stuff like that. But ultimately, you know, that we should have the right to protest. Mm. That's the bottom line. And I think, you know, it's already been, you know, echoed here already, but there obviously is a political narrative. Mm. And I think, you know, if you've done an appeal and they're saying there's no new evidence, surely the people that have had their cases acquitted or they've had lesser sentences, I'm not a lawyer, but surely that's some kind of new evidence that actually, what's the difference there? So I'm really sorry that your daughter's in the situation.
I can't see that it's not a good use of taxpayers' money keeping your daughter in prison for 5 years, is it?
No,
it's a total waste. Ridiculous.
I think that the message it sends is not the message that they hope it would send, actually. And I think, what a waste of money, what a waste of your daughter's life, when actually, like you said, she's, you know, gone into court, she's, you know, been able to empathise, she didn't injure any person. Property at the end of the day can be rebuilt.
Well, that's criminal damage, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is what they were charged with for throwing the statue away. But of course the jury then decided they were justified. Mm. Maybe the jury wouldn't decide she was justified because she broke a window. Mm. Okay, well, that's community service, isn't it?
Well, it should have been community service, yeah.
Absolutely.
So have you been to visit your daughter?
Yeah. She was in Bristol at Eastwood Park, which in itself is not a very great prison, as there's been a recent report on how awful it is there. But luckily, she's gone to at Eastwood Park, she's gone to HMP Downview. So it's a bit of a trek because it's in Surrey, but
that's a long way, isn't it?
Yeah. But I'd rather her be there than in the Eastwood Park, because it was not a very nice environment to be in, and she's noticed quite a lot of changes in this other prison. I'm going on the 26th, actually, so...
So how's she settling? I hate to use that, how's she settling in, because it's going to be a while, isn't it?
Well, she's been there a year now, which I think was a little bit, which was a bit wobbly then, because it's thinking, especially when she's seeing all these other people just going in and out for 5-10 months. Mm-hmm. But she's sort of kind of resigned herself to being there. She knows that she's been victimised and set an example of. But she's done some courses in there. You know, she's learned how to crochet. She's been making lots of crocheted clothes. She plays the guitar, so she sings. And she's trying to keep herself fit. She's just trying to get by her time. I mean, she knows everything I'm trying to do. She knows the campaign because I've set up with the Justice for Bristol Protesters. But she's obviously can't have any false hopes. You know, she's thinking she's going to be there for two and three quarter years actually in, and then two and three quarter years on licence.
Okay, so you're organising something next week, aren't you, on the anniversary of the riot?
It's not an incident.
The peaceful protest that the police charged into.
Yeah, there is going to be an event on Tuesday, the 21st, which is 2 years after the protest. And it's in the Bear Pit at 5:30. So there's going to be everybody getting together there, a few
speeches.
So that's
St. James Barton Roundabout, for people that don't know, the bottom of Gloucester Road.
That's the one, yeah. And there's going to be a sort of march up to Bridewell for some more speeches, and then a little march up Stokes Croft afterwards.
Is that against the law now that this bill's come in? There's too much noise?
I think I don't think it's actually against the law to protest.
Yeah, and of course what it is, it gives the police have discretion as well.
Right, okay.
So they may decide, and they ought to decide, that they're going to take a cooperative approach to these protesters. They should.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been on quite a few protests since the Kill the Bill one, and in Bristol, and they've actually been okay. You know, there's not either there's been no police, or there's been very few.
Yeah, well, when we used to organise big Stop the War protests, we used to go in and tell them that we were having the protest, and say that's fine, you know, and they'd send somebody along to just check it was all okay, because one of the problems with very big protests is that you've got traffic problems. So that you need to make sure that people aren't going to get run over and things like this, you know. But, I mean, in Bristol, there has always been a tradition of people doing spontaneous protests about all sorts of things. And obviously that came to a head with the Colston statue issue, which went all over the world. But the police there, Andy Haywood, who was in charge on that day, as far as I was concerned, he did an excellent job because he videoed it all. And then if they want to prosecute, they can. And the police recommend it, but don't bother prosecuting.
We've obviously got a situation with the right kind of protest and the wrong kind of protest, haven't we? So this is political policing.
Well, I think from the police's point of view, they saw this as an attack on the police station and all the rest of it, which it wasn't, you know. I mean, it's totally exaggerated.
It was a peaceful protest outside the police station.
Yes, yes.
About this specific.
Well, I mean, when Mark Duggan was shot in London, was the relatives went to the police station and nobody came out to talk to them, which then started. A fight started, and it went all around the country, and five people ended up dead, and millions of pounds worth of damage.
More and more people started gathering around the police station, didn't they? Down there.
This is the problem. People who don't think that things could go down the drain in this country lack all imagination. This is exactly the sort of thing that started in Northern Ireland in 1969, and it all seems safe enough, and then suddenly whoosh, 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 and before you know it, and the police really have to think carefully about what their image is with young people. Mm. You know, if they get really to be seen to be the enemy, then that's no good for them, and it's no good for the rest of us, is it?
I think that's already, yeah, a big challenge that we've got around.
It is.
Yeah.
And that's not because, the police need to recognise that it's in their own best interests.
Mm. Absolutely,
To be seen to be even-handed and reasonable.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of this is about resources and money and where that money's going. That's, for example, towards traveller sites. We've now got some traveller sites apparently being put together by our Marvin the Marvellous Mayor, Marvin Rees. Heidi, before we get off the topic of your daughter, can you tell us where and when this protest is taking place again? Hopefully there won't be any charging into this one by the police.
Hopefully not. It's going to be on the 21st of March, in the Bear Pit at St James around
James Roundabout. So that's next Tuesday, isn't it?
Yeah, next Tuesday at 5:30, everybody gathering in the Bear Pit.
And what do you think the prospects for getting something done about your daughter's sentence? I mean, in the old days, you used to get these programmes on TV, Rough Justice and things like that. Your daughter would have been the star of the show, because it's quite obvious for anyone dispassionate looking at it that this is disproportionate.
Well, I have written to a number of politicians and the House of Lords and the Mayor, but I didn't get any response from him. I have recently got a response from Jenny Jones, the clerk of her cabinet from the House of Lords, who I've got to get back to. And I'm just hoping that if we can get it out into the mainstream media, and if people can see what's happened and how the total miscarriage of justice has been happened to her, that somebody's going to see, and it's going to turn the tables. But I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm a little bit naive about it, but I really hope that it will.
Well, so do we. And one of the things, I mean, it's pretty appalling that you haven't had a response from the mayor. I thought he was interested in issues to do with the victimisation of ethnic minorities, but apparently not. Anyway, we're going to look now at the last Friday. Journalist Joanna Booth had booked in on the waiting list to go to something called the One City Gathering, which happens every 2 years here in Bristol, and it's now the place where things happen. So almost all the policy making, if not all the policy making that the mayor does, because of course he ignores the councillors and the full council, as we've just heard with the motion to do with the youth service, it's formulated by these various what he calls thematic boards, which are all staffed by people that he personally appoints. So this is the place where all of those boards get together to have a big chat about what the city's been doing and whereabouts it's going. The only trouble is there are no councillors. Generally, if a councillor wants to go, there may be one or two that are on specific committees. They are invited. But councillors as a whole cannot go to these meetings. The public as a whole cannot go to these meetings. And journalists who wish to go to the meetings to report on them cannot go to these meetings. So this is the One City Gathering, which seems to me to be something like a way of dividing the city rather than bringing the city together. Really, with just the mayor's mates all patting themselves, each other on the back, and saying, isn't it wonderful what we've done? And isn't our plan, aren't our plans for the future fantastic too? And what was most shocking about this, really, for me, I mean, shocking is a word you shouldn't use as a journalist nowadays because so much is shocking, was that Joanna Booth got a message on Thursday evening, just before last week's show here, from the mayor's office, who had organised this One City Gathering, saying, your tickets to this event have been cancelled. We have decided to make it an invite-only gathering. And that's the main policy-making get-together for the city. So, Marty, it sounds to me as if a policy in the city, that is the politics of the city, has basically been privatised and that it is now being run like a company, a corporation, and also that it's a form of invite-only democracy. So you're only invited to participate in formulating policy if the mayor personally likes you and taps you up on the back.
Well, as we were saying earlier, the mayoral system is open to be, you know, it depends on the interpretation of whoever is the mayor. I mean, George Ferguson, when he was the mayor, of course he was very keen on having mayors, I've never been keen on them, he decided he was going to have all of the different political parties in his cabinet, but that's because he could decide to do that. Marvin, on the other hand, has decided that he only wants people that he has approved. Now, in theory, that when the Conservatives brought forward this idea of mayors, the idea was that mayors would be able to just get things done, you know, be able to ride roughshod over anybody who's in the way. It would be a much more can-do sort of a system. And if people didn't like the mayor, they could vote them out, which is like having the sort of mayor, like Mayor Daley used to run Chicago like that. You know, nobody crossed Mayor Daley in Chicago for, you know, two generations.
Well, nobody crossed Al Capone either.
Well, no, but I'm just trying to say that this is the idea behind it. But I think Marvin has been far too enthusiastic for the authoritarian powers that he's been given. He doesn't have to do this if he didn't want to, but he has chosen to do it. And I think there was the referendum, really. I mean, most people are not that engaged with this. So even when the referendum was on about to get rid of the mayor, it was only a fraction of the population participating in the referendum.
One by one, all the supporters, including Ferguson, including the Conservative Party that were behind it in the first place, since Marvin took over, have just said, well, this is a disaster, and that's why we're now in the situation where the mayor has got very little support, and the whole idea of the mayor was overturned last year, and we're going to be ending the system and going back to the committee system next May. So with this in mind, this One City Gathering, which is everyone else is excluded apart from the mayor's mates, I find it incredible that something like this can happen, really. And in the background to all of this, we had a good discussion last week about the planning system and the way that there seems to be this attempt to push through all these plans to build luxury flats on the zoo. These things which you think are insane. You know, this is a zoo. It's a brilliant public amenity. But no, it's just a piece of real estate that we can flatten it. And, well, actually, they're not going to quite flatten it, but they're nearly going to flatten it and just build a whole bunch of luxury flats on it. I mean, this is supposed to be, Martin, this is supposed to be why we have local authorities, to have some kind of, you know, rein on some of these mass property speculators and developers. But in the last few months and in the last couple of years, and particularly in the next year before Marvin is booted out by the people, it looks as if there's an absolute free-for-all where people can build anything they want, anywhere they want.
Well, I think the idea behind having mayors for the Conservatives is to is to, they believe that, that they cut all the funding for...
Hang on, he's a Labour mayor.
No, I'm just talking about the overall context, okay? So what happens is they cannot keep up the funding for things like the youth service. So they then think, how can we find a way to find money for things like the youth service? Ah, they've made the business rate is going to be repatriated to the local council.
Well, they've also got this clean air charge, yes, as well. They're charging.
All right,
so
in other words, they've got to find other sources of income.
I don't know if you
rather than central government grants.
I mean, in Venice today, they announced that they're having a tax for everybody that comes into Venice. Not in a car, but any visitor to Venice is going to have to pay whatever it is.
Venice is a different, it's a special case.
No. Well, people come to Bristol. It's a tourist destination, just like they go to Venice, actually.
Yeah.
And the idea of actually charging not just cars, but people, when they come into the city, it's like a toll booth come in. You get off at Temple Meads and click, you've got to pay your toll.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point is that the whole idea of this is that Labour mayors would then be forced to get into bed with property developers and so on in order to have an income stream which would allow them to be re-elected. Yeah, because previously, most of the money that was spent, particularly in deprived communities, comes from central government grant, based on how deprived the community is. So we're now moving towards... And they were hoping that, that all these cuts in things like youth services would be blamed on the Labour mayors in the areas. And of course, the other thing that the Tories didn't really take on board was that it was going to be Labour mayors in the big cities. They imagined that they were, I mean, Ferguson was a bit of an outlier on that one. And I think the problem for me with Marvin is he's been a bit too enthusiastic about
all
this.
Well, he certainly has.
He ought to have been saying, look, this is actually a bit of a con. As a mayor of Bristol, I can't do much because my money's being cut. And I'm not necessarily going to agree to all of these property developments. We need to change the national government.
So, Heidi, what do you make of this whole mayor business? I mean, I know it's peripheral to your daughter's case, but, I mean, it does seem as if we've got a very different system in charge than we had even 10 years ago before the mayor came along.
Well, yeah, I mean, it goes to show that people don't want the mayor now, so why did they bring him in the first place?
Well, I suppose we didn't know what the consequences were going to be. But anyway, on this planning issue, I spoke to, because we've had this week's Development Control Committee was due to meet to decide on the zoo and various other very controversial planning decisions around the city. But I noticed on the website, the meeting's cancelled. And this never normally happens. The Development Control Committee cancelled. So I contacted the chair, Richard Eddy, who's a Conservative. And he reassured me. He said, oh, well, there's just one or two things that need to be sorted out. The officers have told us. One of those is that the head of planning is Colin something. Well, I can't remember his second name, but anyway, he's left either or he's been sacked. So we have no head of development control at the moment here in Bristol because his job's being re-advertised now. Whether that's, I still haven't managed to fathom whether he walked or whether he was pushed out, because what George said last week, previous Mayor George Ferguson, was that there is an attempt by the Mayor's office to take control of this planning process, which is it's judicially independent. The Mayor can't do that. But obviously, that may be why the head of planning has had to leave, because he's saying, well,
there may be tensions.
You're trying to tell us, what planning applications to accept. Now, the thing is with these, I mean, it sounds boring, and it is boring planning. But if you get yourself a planning application through, you can make hundreds of millions of pounds just on a little transaction like that. As that permission goes through, suddenly it's a license to print millions.
Yeah. I mean, especially in a city like Bristol, which is a relatively successful city in many ways, and therefore the property prices are high. There's a lot of people pushing to get things built.
Especially on Castle Park.
Well,
centre.
Yeah.
Anyway, in the context of this, looking at the One City gathering, I asked Richard Eddy, I said to him, look, well, what do you make of the mayor? What's he doing here? And he cited something, a conversation that he had with Mayor Marvin Rees last summer.
Last probably summer, maybe autumn, do you remember the local democracy reporter Alex Ebert was actually, well, what most of us would be called banned from the mayoral press conferences for asking some awkward questions? Now, I actually asked questions of full council about the banning of the local democracy reporters. Would he revisit this and open it? And he actually had the nerve to tell me, oh, I haven't banned anyone. It's just like my birthday party, Richard. I haven't invited you to my birthday, but I haven't banned you. It was the same with the local democracy report. I've not banned them. I'm just not inviting them. It's pedantic, isn't it, Tony?
Oh, yes, Richard, it certainly is pedantic, and it shows a bit of insight into the way that our mayor runs it. He thinks of these council meetings like his birthday party, and he's going to invite people he wants to invite. Actually, the fact is there are security outside these events, so maybe we should just test to see whether we are able to come, as Marvin says. Anyway, we're going to move on to look a little bit at the Labour Party now, and this ongoing scandal, so-called, over anti-Semitism, Martin. Al Jazeera have done most of the brilliant reporting on this, mainly because they're looking at the Israel lobby and their work within the Labour Party and in other countries like the UK. And I noticed yesterday they released their latest one of a series called Al Jazeera Investigations, where they actually talked to this guy called Mr. Ford. Now, who was he?
Well, he was put in by who? I can't remember whether it was Starmer or Corbyn who brought him in to look into what had happened. And the Ford report concluded that, the allegations of anti-Semitism had been used politically. And it was embarrassing to the Starmer leadership. But, of course, he's basically managed to squash what was in the Ford report. And, he's taking a very strident line on this whole issue.
Okay, so let's listen now to this clip from Al Jazeera last night, where they're looking very closely, as the British press are not doing, at what was in this, and also particularly in this clip you'll hear, the relationship between the BBC Panorama programme and Mr. Ford himself, who'd been writing this report for the Labour Party, is a well-respected barrister. But the BBC said, well, we actually want you to take this and this and this out of your report.
During the Cold War, during the time of Ronald Reagan,
the document I'm holding is an email from Karen Whiteman, who's the editor of Panorama. I would be grateful if you would consider amending your report in respect of your references to Panorama so that it more fairly reflects what the programme actually said. I also received emails from John Ware, who was the lead reporter for that documentary.
John Ware's email said,
"Your report has done significant damage to my reputation and to that of the Corporation for Journalistic Integrity. May I ask you to respond by 4 p.m. tomorrow, 11th of October?
I was a little taken aback. The tone was rather like a letter before action that, I might see in litigation. I just came in with a completely open mind, which I'm sure Mr. Ware would say he did too, and he went where his evidence took him. And that's what journalists do. I felt I had a fuller picture because I interviewed not only some of the participants in the programme, but I also interviewed those who hadn't participated in the programme from the alternative faction, as they're often seen. And I would like to think that as I've been a barrister now, I think I'm in my 38th year, that I would have a degree of forensic skill and an ability to try and assess credibility and consistency, because that's what lawyers look for.
The main email used by Panorama featured in the Labour files. It was sent by the party's Director of Communications, Seamus Milne, to Labour's disciplinary unit. Panorama claimed it revealed interference by the leadership in the disciplinary process. Milne's deputy, James Snyder, described how the email referred to a specific case and had been heavily edited.
It reads, "This member is a Jewish activist, the son of a Holocaust survivor. If we're more than very occasionally using disciplinary action against Jewish members for anti-Semitism, something's going wrong. and we're muddling up political disputes with racism. Quite apart from this specific case, I think going forward, we need to review where and how we're drawing the line if we're going to have clear and defensible processes. So how this is used is just the red bit. So these 10 words.
I felt vindicated because you demonstrated graphically that it had been filleted. And I think the filleting meant the context was lost and a more sinister interpretation could be placed upon that email than was ever intended.
Ford refused to alter the wording of his report.
I couldn't go so far as to say that this was deliberate. It just seemed to me to be objectively entirely misleading to have that partial quote.
Ford also expressed concern about a second segment in the Panorama film.
But also included...
It featured a Labour Party investigator who was Jewish describing an interview he'd conducted.
And we finished the interview. The person got up to leave the room and then turned back to me and said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "What do you mean, where am I from?" And she said, "I asked you, where are you from?" And I said, "I'm not prepared to discuss this." And they said, "Are you from Israel?" What can you say to that? You are assumed to be in cahoots with the Israeli government. It's this obsession with the fact that just spills over all the time into anti-Semitism.
The Labour files interviewed the party member involved, who is also Jewish.
When he says, "Where are you from? Are you from Israel?" That's an absolute lie. I didn't say that.
She had a recording of the interview which showed she, in fact, asked what branch of the Labour Party he belonged to.
"So I'm just curious about, like, what branch are you in?"
"I don't think that's relevant."
"Okay."
I was concerned that the two elderly ladies had a tape recording of a meeting where they were later accused of anti-Semitism, which to my ear revealed nothing of the sort. And I think that also found its way into the same Panorama programme. But I hadn't appreciated that, and it wasn't part of my report.
So that is Mr. Ford still trying to work out what his first name was. It might have been John. It wasn't Henry. But anyway, Martin, he looked into all this anti-Semitism in the Labour Party and did a pretty good job, actually. And yet the Panorama programme decided to smear him and also to lie, actually, about what had been said. So, for example, you heard at the end there, I mean, there we've got one of the people interviewed in Panorama saying, oh, that this woman was asking, "Oh, are you from Israel?" And she's got a recording of the conversation where he didn't say that at all.
No, and I think the Panorama programme itself was incredibly, it was incredibly one-sided, let's put it that way. And the source for much of John Ware's material for the Panorama programme came from Labour Party members who were Labour Party full-time workers who were very pro-Israel, and they ultimately sued the Labour Party for anti-Semitism. And one of the things that Starmer did when he took over as the leader, he was getting legal advice that if it went to court, they would not win. But he...
Sorry, it's Martin Ford, QC.
Yeah, let's say, so they were getting legal advice that if these people who were the main source for John Ware's Panorama programme, and of course some of them were in fact ex-people who'd worked for the Israeli government, for example, that if they went to court to claim that they'd been discriminated against as Jews, they would fail. That was the legal advice that the Labour Party was given. But Starmer, off his own bat, decided that he was going to settle out of court with these people, former employees of the Labour Party, and they got millions of pounds of damages without going to court. that millions of pounds of damages are paid out of my subs that I've paid to the Labour Party in 1975.
The advice
we gathered, if they went to court, they wouldn't. And that's one of the reasons why the Labour Party's got no money, because millions of pounds were given to these people who are essentially wreckers. And they wouldn't have won.
I'm reminded of this police superintendent in North Wales who was awarded tens and hundreds of thousands of pounds in damages because he'd been accused by Private Eye and other publications, The Independent, I think, of being a paedophile whilst he was a police officer. And then a few years later, it turned out he had been a paedophile. And so the court case that had awarded him these damages against the newspapers was complete fraud. So anyway, he died just after that happened in prison. But the fact is, we've just heard another case of miscarriage of justice here, as well as this whole business of what's been going on with the Labour and anti-Semitism. And actually, this is it's not actually a misjudgment in a court case. It's actually that the Labour Party leader, Keir Starmer, has caved in before even taking it to court.
That's right. The legal advice he was given is if this goes to court, they will lose. But he overruled that for political reasons, saying, no, we've got to be seen to be doing something about anti-Semitism, so we'll just pay these people off. But they were paid millions of pounds. Extraordinary. I mean, it's nice work if you can get it. Make a spurious allegation about Labour anti-Semitism and then get millions of pounds to reward your spurious allegation.
Everybody should be aware of this. Every time there's some news coverage about an allegation means nothing. I can allege that we're broadcasting live from the moon. It doesn't mean a thing. And you know, this the idea that you can make an allegation and suddenly it's in the news is a ridiculous concept, where there has to be some sort of a judicial process by which an allegation is tested before it can ever be news.
Yes, but I think Starmer's line is that this is a political thing and we've got to try and excise the curse of anti-Semitism from the Labour Party. But of course, there is very little evidence of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. Compared to the society in general, let alone the grassroots of the Tory Party.
Smearing Labour, and Jeremy Corbyn particularly, as a racist.
Yes. They didn't dare to do it directly. They said he's protected other races. But now, of course, we all know that he's an anti-Semite. And, you see, Roger Waters has just been banned. All of his gigs in Germany have been banned on the grounds that he's a notorious anti-Semite, which, of course, is rubbish. He just opposes Israeli policy. And, of course, the Israeli policy is the thing that's the issue here. And they've worked really hard. I can't remember the name of the MP, but it was Shai Moffat, the Mossad guy, the Al Jazeera expose of that.
Shai Massot, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He was the political attaché.
That's right, and he was talking to a Labour MP, Jones, somebody or other. And
I mean, anyway,
and he was saying, well, we've got £1 million to spend on changing Labour Party policy.
Is it anti-Semitic to ask someone if they are from the Israeli embassy?
Well, in actual fact, they didn't ask. She didn't say that.
No, but even if she had, would it be anti-Semitic to ask?
Well, I would argue not, especially if it's true. Because, of course, the Director of Communications for the current Labour Party did used to work for the Israeli state.
If you were to say, I dislike Jews or something like that, then that is anti-Semitic. But if you're just asking somebody, are you from the Israeli embassy? I mean, it's a perfectly reasonable question to ask
One of these people apparently made the allegation that they were told in an informal way, chatting to Labour Party workers, that Hitler hadn't done enough and that the Holocaust hadn't been successful. Now, anybody listening to that, what Labour Party person, especially a full-time Labour Party worker, is going to say anything like that? It's basically made up. Made up nonsense.
Okay, well, I'll put a full version of that up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. The Ford response is the Panorama Corbyn smears. Al Jazeera investigates the latest edition of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Later, we must have a look at the budget, Martin, particularly in the context of these dodgy banks, Credit Suisse particularly, and we could go through the speeches of Jeremy Hunt, the speeches of Nook. Let's just have a little excerpt from Jeremy Hunt's budget speech on Thursday.
Today, the Office for Budget Responsibility forecasts that because of changing international factors and the measures I take, the UK will not now enter a technical recession this year.
So, that's all we do. I think we can just leave it at that. I will put a link up to, there's an excellent iPaper summary of some of the, because I mean obviously it takes a while to go through the budget to see, well, hang on, usually the day after you start to realise, well, this is what he's really up to. Not a technical recession, Martin. This word technical I find a little bit irksome.
Well, they never used to be things like recessions. They used to be depressions, trade depressions. And the term recession was invented in order to make it sound more straight, you know, it's not a depression, it's a recession. And of course, the idea of recessions, you come out of recessions, it's quite natural. And therefore, in economics textbooks, if you're in negative growth territory for two quarters, that is technically a recession. But in any case, what we're talking about is an economy which is not exactly firing on all cylinders and is clinging on by its fingertips.
It's a political party that's not firing on all cylinders. There is I mean, there are various people have had a good old look at this, and of course, Hunt doesn't announce this straight away, and Starmer can't really because he doesn't get a proper good long look at the budget speech before he gets to speak against it. He's got to pick up on what Hunt has said mostly. So there's apparently a stealth 4p rise in income tax to pile pressure on Sunak over squeezed workers. The Chancellor promised that his budget would help to grow the economy, rejecting calls by Conservative colleagues to cut taxes. The UK's tax burden will hit its highest level since the Second World War, as £30 billion of stealth taxes take effect in the wake of Jeremy Hunt's budget. The increase in the income tax bill is equivalent to raising the basic rate by 4p, according to the Office for Budget Responsibility. So that is really, this is the government itself saying, the OBR saying, actually what's really going on here is a roughly 4% rise in income tax. The thing is, of course, is also for the super rich, there are tax breaks.
Yes. When you've got inflation like we've got now, if you do not upgrade income tax thresholds in line with inflation, then you get what's called fiscal drag. In other words, the amount of tax that you take in tax increases automatically because people move into higher tax brackets because of the inflationary pressure that's going on. I must admit, I haven't had time to look at every aspect of what's going on.
Well, apparently it's the high earners that have done really well out of this, but yeah, even then, there's some dispute about that. Labour would reverse what the Rachel Reeves said. Labour would reverse the gilded giveaway, she said, and urge the Chancellor and the government to think again about scrapping the cap. Rachel Reeves told on Sky News that the wrong priority at the wrong time for the wrong people. This is the surprise decision to remove the lifetime allowance on pensions, the amount that can be saved in a pension scheme before being taxed. And so this is really only for the 15,000 highest earners in the country, Martin. And this isn't going to make much of a difference.
It's been justified by the government in that there are consultants leaving the health service because they've already passed the threshold, and we've got a problem with retaining consultants, so we've got to give them a tax break. But of course, it isn't just for consultants, as Rachel Reeve said. Well, we could have some special measure for NHS consultants. Don't have to give everybody in that bracket a free lunch.
Quite a lot of scrutiny of this budget, and one of them articles, this I article talks about, is by 2028 the government tax take will amount to roughly 37.7% of GDP, almost 5% higher than the pre-pandemic levels. So that would be around 32. We're now at 37% of GDP. So increased taxes. I mean, this is, it looks to me a little bit like we've got a Goldman Sachs government, really. Rishi Sunak's ex-Goldman Sachs. This is the city saying, how much more can we squeeze out of them and make it look good?
Yeah, well, the thing about the way the Tory press present this in their business columns is that isn't this, you know, and then they're worried about it. There's two, we've got the same level of taxes. In World War II, at the end of World War II, the tax burden was actually on the wealthiest, and things like VAT were much smaller. So in actual fact, a lot of what this tax burden is poor people paying VAT on their grocery
bills. But it's also income tax freezes to tax thresholds brought in by Rishi Sunak when he was Chancellor, and now continued by Mr Hunt, mean an extra 3.2 million will be paying income tax who would have been exempt if the thresholds rose in line with inflation. Well, this is one of the wonderful things about inflation, is it just means you're bringing more and more and more people into paying income tax that could, of course, barely afford it.
That's right. And at the same time, you were allowing people at the top end to escape from that. So, I mean, it's not that surprising that a Tory budget is in the interest of the Tory donors, the people who give money to the Tory party. They need to be helped, because otherwise they won't give money to the Tory party to fight the next election, so we've got to give them some red meat. People on low incomes are less likely to vote Tory, so we might as well just take some money off them. Because, you know, even if we were nice to them, they're still not going to vote for us, so why should we help them out?
Anyway, I'll put in a link up to this budget analysis, which I think is pretty good, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and send it out to our subscribers on email. And you can email me, if you'd like to, on our show page, via our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and there's a contact tab on there. You just send me an email and I'll add you to the list. Don't bother if you're on Gmail. And I'm still trying to figure out, find a way of telling people that who are on Gmail. If anyone listening knows how to do that, please do let me know how I can actually send an email to them, because what the Gmail system does is it just prevents any, it bounces back every single email that I send to a Gmail address now, as part of this weekly email I send. So I really must get round to putting up the error message that it gets sent back by literally hundreds of people. Hundreds of you over the years have been added to that list with Gmail addresses, and they all just come bouncing straight back now because Gmail has decided it's not going to send emails to you from me. Housing experts, Martin, have criticised the Chancellor for not offering any measures to tackle the housing crisis in the budget.
Well, that's the elephant in the room, isn't it? The housing crisis stems from decades of policy which has encouraged property speculators and elderly homeowners who vote Tory at the expense of young people who need somewhere to live. And they're not doing anything about any of that, because they'd have to change the whole attitude that they've got, and they're not going to do that.
Well, they must do at some point, surely. Maybe just before the next election.
No,
if they want
to
hang on to Red Wall Street seats.
No, no. I think the Red Wall seats, they want to see higher public expenditure on things like hospitals and schools. Housing is the biggest issue in big cities like Bristol, because it's just so expensive to get anywhere to live. And there's no way round this in the short run, because the whole system has been rigged in favour of the owner-occupiers in the marginal constituencies in the south of England who dominate the Tory vote. And they've got to be looked after. And they're looked after at the expense of the poorer, younger people in the inner cities. And that's because they're the ones who vote Tory. And of course, poorer people in the inner cities are often not registered to vote. And we've got the May council elections coming up across the country. And many people will turn up to vote to find that they can't vote because they haven't got a vote. They haven't got a photo ID, which of course is a further disenfranchisement. And it's an ongoing thing. Okay, I mean, the Tory party isn't there to help poor people.
So in a nutshell, what would you do if you were Chancellor? I mean, what seems to be happening is every year they're making things worse. We're heading towards a bigger, a steeper and steeper cliff, and bigger potential crash.
Well, we are indeed.
What would you do?
Well, the obvious thing to do is build council houses, which is what Tory governments used to do in the 1950s.
But won't they be looking at that and saying, well, actually, if we start doing that, that may depress the price of housing and that we could end up with a housing crash?
No, because what you do is, if you had a systematic policy of building council housing, or perhaps just buying existing housing and using it as council housing, you don't necessarily have to build. What happens over time, if you do it over a long time, is that the house prices stabilise, and people don't imagine that their house is their pension plan. You pay what you need to live in the house you live in, and it doesn't appreciate much. And this is what happens in other European countries. But in this country, the politics of making people into homeowners through subsidy. Don't forget the council house stock was sold off at less than it was worth. So the people who were already the tenants, they got to buy their council houses at less than it was worth. That's not a market. That's a subsidy. But of course, that is actually a subsidy to those people at the expense of other people who haven't got anywhere to live at all. And that's what that's for policy has always been, to build a political base for the Conservative Party by handing out public assets to our supporters. And that's what they've done. And they're not going to change that anytime soon.
A bizarre local story. Well, I say local, Cheltenham. An American spy working at GCHQ has been stabbed in Cheltenham. Story by Martin Evans in the Daily Telegraph on Tuesday. A woman stabbed in an alleged terrorist attack. I mean, whether this is terrorism. In Cheltenham was an American spy working at nearby GCHQ. The victim was targeted by a lone knifeman as she sat in her car at a leisure centre in the Gloucestershire town on the 9th of March. She was rushed to hospital where she underwent surgery and remains in a stable condition. The 29-year-old man arrested at the scene was initially held on suspicion of attempted murder. On March the 11th, police confirmed he had been rearrested on suspicion of terrorism. It's now been reported the woman attacked was a US intelligence agent who had been seconded to the government's secret listening station at GCHQ. The exact nature of her role has not been revealed. It's thought she could have been working for the US National Security Agency, which has close links with the security services, Martin. Oh, the pair were seen arguing before the stabbing.
Well, it seems rather bizarre to me. I mean, if she's a secret spy, how is the person who's stabbing her to know who she is? I mean, how did he find out who she was? If he's going to be charged with terrorism, he's got to be charged. I mean, if they're having some altercation and then he stabs her, well, that isn't terrorism, is it? That's an altercation.
Well, the Americans may have demanded that this is a terrorist charge because it brings in various other, you know, ways of covering things up.
Yeah, maybe. Well, we don't know enough about this, do we?
One local told the Daily Mail they were either parked or had pulled into the car park when she was stabbed, and she managed to get out of the car to get to the leisure centre, but there was definitely some sort of argument taking place beforehand. Anyway, interesting, bizarre sort of things taking place here. Can you just say something about the National Security Agency and GCHQ? Because these are quite important organisations, aren't they? The way they operate here in Cheltenham. And it does sound as if, I mean, we had Anne Sikoulis, who was working for the Americans, RAF Croughton, killing the young lad on a motorbike because she was driving on the wrong side of the road. So there seems to be quite a lot of American over here, Martin, embedded in our security services.
Well, I mean, in the past, what used to be the Five Eyes standard operating procedure is the National Security Agency in the US is not allowed to spy on, in theory, on US citizens, and GCHQ, in theory, is not supposed to be spying on British citizens. So what they do is GCHQ does all the spying on the American citizens and then passes that back to the Americans and vice versa.
But we may also
Given up on that now. They just spy on everybody.
As we'll be hearing after the break, we're also seeing now a kind of locking down of Europe by the United States in this war with Russia.
Well, that's bigger geopolitics than just who is the National Security Agency.
But GCHQ is quite an important part of all
of
that, isn't it?
Of course it is. I mean, it was the National Security Agency who tipped off the Israelis in September 2019 that a pandemic was coming out of China, which meant that they had foreknowledge of the pandemic.
But this is not the news. This is not the big news. The big news of the week is revolved around a chap called Gary Lineker. I'm not sure if you know who he is.
He's something to do with football, I believe, isn't
he? Yeah, it's been dominating the news all week, where he is comparing the Conservative Party's attempts to stop the migrants coming across the Channel to 1930s Nazi Party. So what do you make of that?
Well, what he said was the language that the government is using is reminiscent of it. And then, of course...
Is it?
Well, that's his opinion. I'm just reporting what he said. Okay.
I know. I mean, I've for years and years been doing stuff with the Journalists Union about quite a lot of journalists over the years, not just at the BBC, elsewhere too, have been sacked for things they said on social media. And yet here we've got a situation where the journalists have stood together with Lineker, and basically the BBC has found out just how little power it has to hire and fire its top stars. And, you know, many people are saying, well, actually, Gary Lineker has got more power in the BBC than the Director General.
Well, I mean, don't forget that for many, many years, Jeremy Clarkson was all over social media going on about how Gordon Brown should be shot and all the rest of it. And of course, don't forget, these people are light entertainment. They're not the BBC political staff. And are you going to say that people can't have their... I've got no problem.
Well, people can have their views, yes. But you see, the thing is, it's a bit like the protests. It's the right view or the wrong view, and the right protest or the wrong protest.
Well, that's right.
I mean, certain things are considered to be unacceptable, others fine.
Well, I think what's gone on with the appointment of the new Director General of the BBC, and also the guy who's in charge of it completely...
The chairman...
is that they want to make the BBC more like the Tory press. Why isn't the BBC like the Tory press? The Tory press is impartial. The BBC isn't impartial. Now, I would argue that the BBC does have a responsibility to be impartial about political matters, and political journalists like, you know, Paul Mason when he worked there or whatever, they've got to be quite careful about what they say and when they say it, Emily Matterless. But I think somebody who's a football commentator is allowed to have whatever eccentric views they're entitled to. They're a football commentator. It doesn't, you know, Jeremy Clarkson is quite clearly a dyed-in-the-wool Tory. That doesn't mean he can't have a programme on the BBC. And keep his, reactionary Tory opinion. He was sacked because he punched his line manager. Nobody's allowed to punch their line manager. Anybody understands that. You know, that's a disciplinary matter.
If you say that Sweller Braverman is a Nazi, is that okay?
Well, I don't think that's what Gary...
Well, that's what he was hinting at, wasn't he?
Hinting at it, and that's his opinion. And you know what? That's my opinion, too. A lot of what they're doing is, in fact, reminiscent of the 1930s. Why shouldn't we say that?
Why? What they're trying to do is to stop people coming across illegally into the country.
No, it's not
so
illegal.
It's not illegal to get on a dinghy and come to Britain. What you're trying to do is just speak over me there. To say that you can't have control your borders is not Nazi, is it?
There's a debate going on in the Parliament and in the media about what should happen about these refugees coming across the Channel.
This is about whether countries are sovereign or whether internationalism rules and globalism rules, or whether people can just move around the world the way they wish, or whether countries can actually police their own borders or not.
Okay. Can the Italians, the Greeks and the Spanish, can they stop these people coming onto their borders? They're coming from Syria into Greece. They're mostly coming from Libya.
What about the organised crime gangs bringing them over? What about them?
Well, organised crime gangs, you need to deal with that.
Just be infiltrated and arrested and sent to jail?
Do you know what? There's been a massive increase in the cocaine production in the last 2 years.
Well,
we're just talking
here in Bristol about how organised crime is doing so well. County Lines is doing so well because young people are finding it so difficult to get ahead that they're brought into these organised crime gangs.
We can't do anything about the migrant crime gangs either. We've got laws.
So is organised crime gangs, are they in charge here in Bristol and across the Channel?
Organised crime gangs function on the back of social breakdown. And there is a massive increase in drugs coming into this country. We've had laws against drugs coming into this country forever. But it doesn't stop them coming in. They come in.
And so it's par for the course for this economic meltdown,
really.
Well,
refugees are going to increase. Because we've had wars in Libya.
Are these economic migrants or refugees?
Mostly
from Albania.
No, Albania is a red herring. And in any case, in Albania, as I've explained to you before, the Thatcherite economic policy imposed on Albania since they got rid of Maoism has actually led to mass unemployment
so
in Albania.
You're in favour of people trafficking?
No, I'm not, Tony. I'm not in favour of people trafficking. Are you in favour of refugees being drowned?
Of course not.
Oh, then. So in that case, you've got to do something about it.
You have to stop these organised crime gangs, as far as I can see. That seems to be the best way to do it.
All right, we're not going to agree about
this.
Well,
no, I'm not asking to agree. Let's just put our points of view. And also, by the way, all this Lineker business came up in Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, too.
Dear Starmer.
Mr Speaker, the problem is the chair of the BBC isn't just any old Tory donor. He's so close to the Prime Minister, he's been described as his mentor. Yeah. He helped arrange an £800,000 credit line for the former Prime Minister. A minor detail he forgot to tell the Select Committee, which scrutinised his appointment. Does the Prime Minister think that his friend's position is still tenable?
Prime Minister.
Well, Mr Speaker, as I've just said,
the office for the independent office for Commissioner of Public Appointments is reviewing what was a rigorous independent process to appoint the chairman. Instead of prejudging and preempting that review, we should let it conclude and wait for the outcome. That is the right way to do things, and that's what the government will do.
So Goldman Sachs clinging on to power, but I mean, it's looking as if this whole process for appointing the chairman of the BBC is dodgy. But also the BBC's boss. I mean, I look, as an ex BBC employee myself. Well, not an employee; I was a freelance there, working under contract. And is it a credible organisation? There's a lot of Martin, is being used to bring about a kind of wave of opinion saying we're not going to pay our licence fee. The BBC's finished.
Well, Nadine Dorris was openly talking about abolishing the licence fee and getting rid of the
BBC. The Tories succeeded not only destroying the NHS, but also destroying the BBC in this
term. Yeah, well, they never liked the BBC, because the BBC does have a remit to be impartial. They want the BBC to be more like the Daily Mail.
Gary Lineker's not impartial, is he?
No, he's not. But then on the other hand, he's a football commentator.
I mean, I think it's a bit absurd to expect people to be impartial. I don't think there's such a thing as impartiality.
There isn't.
And amongst, of course, journalists, all the journalists I know have got views about things.
Exactly. So in other words, what you need to do is you have to have their views up in the open.
Can include other points of view.
That's right. Don't
pretend that you're impartial. You can include other points of view to make an impartial broadcast or whatever, but don't pretend that as producer, particularly the Zionist lobby at the BBC is massive, is very, very powerful. Yeah. How can they pretend to be impartial, but they do?
Well, I think that it's very difficult for anybody to be impartial for the reasons you've just said. But as you say, there are ways around that, but you just make sure that you've got a plurality of views, particularly on politics programmes.
Well, there's most definitely...
When it comes to people who've made their careers in things like football and football commentating, or music, or comedy, you can't make those people toe the line.
But
it's not
reasonable. Don't you think that it's possible that the only reason that Gary Lineker has become a superstar on TV is because his views fit?
He's very popular, and there was massive...
Is it just popularity that sends people to the top?
Or is it if you happen to
have the right points of view?
He's the top.
It's the right point of view or the wrong point of view? The right story, the wrong story? The right protest, the wrong protest?
Well, Gary Lineker's liberal views are well known, okay? He happens to be a very... He's the highest paid person at the BBC, I understand. He earns £6.5 million a year.
Well, it's a joke. I mean, what annoys me so much, listening to all the stuff about Saturday, when they said, oh, we're not going to do it actually. Well, if you people are serious about running the BBC, give a few, like, local radio sports journalists, or give a few people who are the very lowest rungs of the sports department of the BBC, give them an opportunity to do the programme. If one of the big top stars decides they're not going to do it, you say, hey guys, there's a free chair. Fancy having a go at Match of the Day this week?
Loads of people that work with Gary Lineker on Match of the Day refused to do the show.
Yes, but you might well find other people would jump at the opportunity to do it. People are lower down the hierarchy.
If you do that, then you're escalating the situation.
Well, are you actually trying to put a programme on rather than giving in?
Well, no. Gary Lineker has won this fight because he was always going to win it, Tony.
Well, maybe.
And in actual fact, his views are quite popular. Some people think his views are popular, Martin.
I'm saying it's not unbiased. But, and there are other points of view in the House of Commons too, not just Keir Starmer's.
Danny Crunger. Mr. Speaker, on Monday, the Home Secretary said that in recent decades the immigration to this country has been too high, and all the benches opposite howled their disapproval. They want higher immigration, not lower. We need to do this rather than importing cheap foreign labour. We need to invest in the skills of our own young people and encourage businesses.
Well, Mr. Speaker, my honourable friend is right that we do need to encourage long-term investment in the domestic workforce. We'll hear more from this in the Chancellor later this afternoon, but the Department for Work and Pensions is directing support at sectors with labour shortages, like construction and social care, and our new skills boot camps are part of a dramatic rebooting of our skills system to support workers to get the skills that they need.
So, what do you make of that? Apparently, all this migration isn't really helping the economy at all.
Well, the Tories have made a big deal about how they're going to reduce the level of migration, but in actual fact, this irregular migration is increasing across Europe. And it's actually increased less in Britain than in places like Greece, Spain and Italy, well, as I mentioned earlier.
That was one of our reasonably local MPs, Danny Kruger from Devizes. Ultimately, how do you think the figures stack up? Because surely, you know, what every migrant worker that comes over and takes a job knocks somebody else who also might be a migrant worker out of a job and onto the dole. I mean, this is surely costing rather than benefiting the country.
This is actually what's called...
Not only that, you're also having to pay to put people in hotels and things like that. How can this be a benefit to the economy?
These people who are coming across as refugees are not necessarily a benefit to the economy, although many of them are quite middle class and doctors and so forth, and they could easily be employed if their asylum claims were processed. The real problem is the massive wave of young people which have left this country because of Brexit, the Poles, the Bulgarians, the Romanians, who used to staff all of the hotels and the pubs. Now, we've actually got labour shortages in those kind of areas. And, of course, they're talking about investment. Investment in Britain has gone down since Brexit, and it wasn't very high anyway. And in actual fact,
And since the pandemic, too.
Well, indeed. And also since we've had Tories in power over the last 30, 40 years. The level of investment per worker in this country is pitiful compared to countries like France and Germany.
Well, I don't agree. I look at the whole of Europe, and I see actually what's happening is the US is trying to send the whole of Europe down.
They are indeed, but we've got a particular circle of hell to be in because we've got rid of people who'd already integrated into, you know, they'd just gone home, who could have been working for us and paying taxes. Don't forget, these are generally younger people, they pay taxes, they don't in fact use up much resources because they don't use the health service, and in actual fact they're paying for the health service.
Anyway,
so if you get rid of them, you've then got to find and fill the hole in.
Talking of circles of hell, the health service seems to be being turned into hell, even though there has been some sort of settlement apparently this week with the health workers. Let's just have a listen to PMQs. There's a couple of questions with horrific stories about what's going on in our hospitals under the Tories.
But
Speaker, the government promised the 40 new hospitals 3 years ago, and the Prime Minister's just expressed his intention to proceed again. 2 years ago, in St Mary's Paddington Hospital serving my constituency, a ward ceiling fell in during floods, the eye hospital was closed by a fire, and the birth centre and maternity wards were threatened by structural problems. This week, trust managers said, the infrastructure is having an increasing impact on staff and patients, we just can't afford to continue to waste money on failing buildings. But the hospital is waiting for the commitment from the government for the funding under the new hospitals programme. Will today be the day that the Prime Minister commits to that specifically?
Yes.
Mr Speaker, as I said in my previous answer, the government is committed to the new hospitals programme. We've committed record sums to NHS capital, not just for that programme, but for smaller scale upgrades across the country. And those conversations with her trust and others are happening in the same way across the country. And I look forward to those conversations continuing.
So they've been offered 5% plus £1,600 one-off payment, which seems a bit cheeky, really, because all it means is that they're going to have another battle in a year's time, the health service, in order to try and keep pace with inflation. So this is, this idea of, well, we'll give you a one-off payment too, it confuses the whole issue about how much money they're getting, because they're getting a specific amount of money just this year. This seems to be just trickery from the government here, making sure that the health workers, yes, they go back to work, but that they're actually not sorting the problem out at all. There's going to have to be a whole other battle takes place in a year's time.
Well, it may well be when it goes to the ballot of the people on strike that they'll vote it down. This is one of the problems for the Tory government, because you say, well, the union bosses could just call the strike off. Well, no, they can't.
The main problem
is... ambulance workers aren't happy with it, they'll vote it down and say we're going on.
We've just heard about the infrastructure in the hospitals, but the main problem is that they are not retaining workers. People are just saying, I've had enough of this because I just cannot afford to pay the bills doing this job.
That's right.
I don't feel, that there's any kind of seriousness in the management and the financing of the health service, so I'm off.
Well, that's right. I mean, that is a clear example. The same is true of teachers. they can't recruit and retain teachers. Now, if you can't recruit and retain people, your targets, it means you're not paying enough. The private sector knows how, realizes this. So the wage settlements in the private sector have been in advance of those in the public sector. And of course, the government then says, and if, don't forget, public sector pay increases do not affect the rate of inflation because there's nothing sold at the end of it. Yeah. Whereas private sector pay increases, that turns up in extra prices for the consumer they're selling stuff.
Good point. I mean, and also it seems to me what's going on is this is all part of the fallout from 2008, really.
Of course it is.
And the idea is that we're just going to get rid of public service and public provision by the government. The government is just going to sit there and pontificate, but actually it will have hardly any resources to spend on anything.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's widely recognised across the developed world that you have to spend more on health every year because people tend to live longer and there's more things to do to save their lives.
If the government doesn't have the money...
And you've got to find the money from somewhere.
Well, poor old Jeremy Hunt. I mean, bless him. God, he's from... was it for the Culture, Media and Sport Department where he was a complete disaster. Then the Health Department where he was an even bigger disaster. And now he's in charge of everything, in charge of all the money. And he was never elected to do that. So in fact, he was non-elected. But even the Conservative Party themselves said, no, get rid of this guy. We don't want him. So let's have another clip from PMQs, also about hospital problems.
Daisy Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. An investigation reported in The Guardian and the BBC revealed that in the last year, on more than 450 instances, sewage was leaking into cancer wards, maternity units and A&E departments. Without urgent action, the legacy of this Conservative government on the NHS will be an image of a nurse cleaning up sewage around a patient in a crumbling hospital. Will the Prime Minister commit to that pledge of building 40 hospitals by 2030, including in West Hertfordshire, and will he establish a fund to repair those hospitals that are in a dire state of disrepair?
Well, Mr. Speaker, we are investing record sums in NHS capital to upgrade dozens of hospitals across the country, but in particular to build the 40 new hospitals, and we are committed in particular to a new hospital scheme at West Hertfordshire Hospital NHS Trust as part of that programme, and the programme is working closely with the Trust on their plans in line with the approach that we have taken nationally.
The voice of Goldman Sachs. Look, they want to run the NHS down before the next general election, Martin, completely, don't they? That's what it seems to me.
Well, I think what they want to do is what they've been doing for years, is they want to pretend that they care about the NHS. You remember the 365 million a week for the NHS if we vote for Brexit on the side of the bus. But at the same time, the funders of the Conservative Party are people like Jacob Rees-Mogg in private, they want to get rid of it. So that it's a huge political problem for them because they know how popular it is, hence that slogan on the side of the bus. But in actual fact, their funders want to get rid of it. And you can see what's happened with dentistry. I mean, we don't really have public dentistry anymore in this country at all. You just can't get it. And if you've got money, you can go and get your teeth fixed.
Well,
and
if you haven't, then you can't. You have to go onto a waiting list, basically, if you're not already in. That's the way it works, isn't it?
Well, many dentists are not taking NHS patients.
They're not
at
even
all.
Taking them on a waiting list.
No, because we've moved to a system similar to the one that existed before 1945, where if you want dentistry, you've got to pay for it. Full whack. And of course, some people can, and they are. And some people can't, and therefore, you know, what used to be the case before the health service, you can tell who poor people are because they're the ones with the dodgy teeth. And that then creates a social divide between those two different groups of people. It's a very obvious
one. It's all a very good incentive to make lots of money, isn't it?
Well, that's right. They need to pull their finger out and get a job with Goldman Sachs, and then they can afford to fix their teeth.
Yeah, and actually that job is just... How can I politely put this? Making money out of everybody else.
Well, that's right. I mean,
the more you screw other people into the ground, the more money you make.
Well, I think the funders of the Tory...
Greed is the motive.
The funders of the Tory party used to be big business, but it's increasingly becoming just the wealthy who want special privileges for themselves to speculate and make money on other people's misfortune. And this is ultimately, I mean, Michael Hudson obviously goes on about this in relation to the US and globally. It's not an effective way to run things. It's actually a very destructive way. And over time, you know, if we go head to head with the Russians, we're going to find that our way of doing things isn't the way to do it. And you do actually need a government that actually wants these things to succeed.
I agree with you. It's an accelerationist policy. This is what it is. The idea is to cause a massive car crash, as worse a car crash of the economy as possible, in order to have the biggest change that's possible, which sounds to me rather like the shock doctrine. But look, we've just heard about the health workers. What about the RMT?
Bob Blackman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In 2016, the current Mayor of London promised zero strikes on London Underground. Today is the 135th day of strikes since then. Will my right honourable friend join with me in condemning those strikes that have brought misery to the travelling public in London, and also condemn the Mayor of London for his failure to address this?
Mr. Speaker, my honourable friend is absolutely right about the misery being inflicted on Londoners by the incompetent running of TfL. It's worth bearing in mind, not only did the party opposite vote against our minimum service levels, which will provide respite for the hard-working British public, that the Mayor of London, since the pandemic, has received £6 billion of additional funding for transport services. So for us to be in the situation that we are find ourselves in today is simply unacceptable.
The London Underground workers have as much right to protect their living standards as anybody else. And, of course, they are, just like other railway workers, in quite a strong position. And they're using that strong position to try and protect their living standards. But don't forget, because of the pandemic and all the rest of it, all of the railways were closed. I mean, the bus service is the same. Ultimately, the government had to take over all of these things and run them at a loss and then subsidise what was going on. That's possibly what we'll have to do if you are going to go to war with Russia, as they seem to be saying on the other side of their mouth. Then things like that will have to happen, and then taxes on the wealthy will have to increase. This is the unsayable thing.
Well, do you know what? The Americans are going to war with Russia, so we'll be hearing about that after the break. But the final item before the break, other than our poem this week, is a chat that you might remember, Martin. We haven't heard from a while. Yanis Varoufakis has been looking at the energy markets and how the energy markets are being manipulated in order to fuel inflation and funnel loads and loads of cash to the energy companies and to the energy company shareholders to make sure that everybody knows if you want to make money nowadays, just put all of it into energy firms and the entire system will funnel loads of money into your pockets.
Yesterday, Ursula von der Leyen came out and announced that the Greek government's scam will be Europeanized. So, you know, comrades in Germany, in France, in Portugal, in Spain, expect the same scam to be coming your way immediately. Well, once they get their act together and they agree on it, because, you know, what the Commission says and Ursula says, nobody cares. But the European Union Council may be deciding to agree with what von der Leyen said yesterday, which is a copy of what the Greek government is doing. Now, listen to what the Greek government is doing. The key, I mean, how did I understand that it's a scam? Because they don't tell you, you know, footnote 3.8, this is where the scam is. You've got to do some detective work. You have to, you know, decipher it yourself. So I'll tell you how the first inkling we had at Mera 25, the team that we were poring over all these regulations, the first inkling we had that this is a scam is when it mentioned that the auction, the daily auction for the wholesale price continues. This, stock exchange in which wholesale producers are competing with one another in an auction continue. Now, the human mind cannot wrap itself around that. If you have a maximum price that is imposed by government on every different power station, why do you need the auction? Isn't that the obvious question to ask? Okay. Now, here it is. This is what they do. Okay. Remember, the price for every megawatt hour that the government imposed from hydro works was 85 euros. Okay? I looked at what the auction yielded, the price. It was 700 during this period. 700. The price cap was meant to be, for those kilowatt hours produced by Hydroworks, it was meant to be 85. Okay? Or 112 for some other ones. Take the 112, which is a bit higher. So this is how it works. The producer of that kilowatt hour or megawatt hour receives the 700 euros that has been determined by the auction in the Netherlands, right? But then they have to give back to the Greek state the difference between the 700 and the price cap of 112, which is 558, right? Or 88, 588. So they give it back to the government. Okay. So far, you think it's stupid. I mean, why do this? Why don't you just ask them to receive 112 instead of receiving 700 and then have to return the 558? So far, no scam, just stupidity, just bureaucracy. Well, here's where the scam comes. The government does not take this money in order to give it to consumers. No. The government takes this money to give it to the retail companies. Now, if you look at every market almost in Europe, the same shareholder that owns the producer owns the retail company. Ah! Caught you. So it is as if I have, you know, I have a company that is producing electricity and I have a company, that is a retail company. So the government, what it does is, you know, they let the pseudo auction determine the price at 700. Okay. They force me to return to the state from my left pocket, which is my pocket as a producer, 588 euros to the government. And the government puts it in my right pocket. Now, is it any wonder that the consumer feels no relief? No, none, zero, zilch. Then what the government does is, okay, to help you, dear consumer, I'm going to borrow money. The government will borrow money, add it to the government budget to subsidize your electricity bill. In other words, to allow you to give the oligarch the money in my pocket that the government has taken from one pocket and put it in another pocket. Now, if this is not a scam, I do not know what the word scam means. This is the definition of a scam. This is happening in Greece. It's been happening since 6th of July. And now this is the proposal by the European Commission in all its glory and greatness for how we're going to deal with. Now, why are they doing this? Because complexity is in the interest of the oligarchy. I just took 23 minutes to explain this to you. Now, no media are going to give me 23 minutes in Greece to explain this to the people out there. Nobody is going to allow the people of France, the people of Portugal, the people of Slovakia, the people of Britain, 23 minutes in order to have somebody explain this to them. You know, you get 20 seconds, 23 seconds, and then you are interrupted. And in the meantime, nobody can understand what's going on. People think, okay, so they are imposing a price cap. They are subsidizing the public. So the government is doing something. No, the government is doing nothing. The government are agents of the oligarchy. They are crooks and they are thieves. And this is a clear-cut case of destroying the capacity of the majority of Europeans to make ends meet in the interest of an oligarchy.
So that's Yanis Varoufakis, a lot quicker than 25 minutes, but he's explaining there, Martin, that basically there's a fake market, false market, even though the actual prices of these electricity coming out of these hydro stations he's talking about, which cost of which is around about 85 euros, there's about nine times is what the consumers and the retail companies are being charged for that electricity. So all this kind of push towards going for sustainable energy like hydro, solar, wind is all being massively overpriced. What they do apparently is they peg it to the price of gas. So the whole thing is a massive fraud, and it's not just here in the UK, it's right across the EU, this policy imposed by the European Commission.
Yeah, I mean, it's the energy companies, the private energy companies are the villains here, which is why, of course, we used to have nationalised energy
industries. Well, this is one of the things he says in there. I'll put the full version of that up on our show page.
Because if it's owned by the government, then you can just get rid of all of that. And you can, I mean, the Russians have been saying, for example, in terms of gas and oil prices, we want to do long-term deals with you to sell you oil and gas at prices which are fixed for 20
years.
Less
than the Yanks. Yes. Anyway, so he says in that piece, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, the full version, he also says there's a couple of things that need to happen. This market in Amsterdam or in the Netherlands needs to be closed down and these brought into public ownership, all these energy firms.
Well, it's an obvious thing to do. And of course, other countries, for example, Russia, have already got a nationalised energy industry. That gives them a huge competitive advantage, of course. Having the energy industry run by private oligarchy means that the cost of living for ordinary people is massively inflated beyond what it might otherwise be, which means that your economy is completely undermined. But it's very good for the people who are the shareholders in these private companies, monopolies. And that's why all of these industries were nationalised in the 1940s by the Labour government. The coal industry, the gas industry, we didn't have one, but that was created as a nationalised industry and so on and so forth. British Petroleum used to be owned by the government. It's not as if this is mad stuff. This is exactly how we used to run it.
We'll be looking at drones, American and satanic in part two. But first, before the break, Patricia Opulenza's latest, she sent me a poem, Ode to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Oh, what a programme, each Friday here, TGMS, always in gear. Raised voices oft, we'll hear each week, as each one wants the chance to speak. Dave on duty to keep things on track, checking levels he never slacks. Argument oft, gruff voices will blow up opinions and often spill into a pool of moody brew as TG moves on with much ado. MS left silenced once again, but waits in line and will explain his points of view beyond compare, a man who's been around, 'tis fair. A duo packed with truth we see, TG the same, but bossy be. Make up, break up. Stop laughing. Make up, breakups. We hear each week TGMS as facts both seek. Top-notch critiques with so much to say on thisweek.org.uk.
If you don't believe in conspiracy theories, just look up the Dark Enlightenment.
Yes. deceive my mind. The lines drawn between the good and the bad. See the blind man, he's shooting at the world. The bullets flying. If you've been bad, Lord, I bet you have. And you've not been hit by flying leather. You'd better close your eyes. You'd better bow your head.
lines drawn between the good of us and the bad of us. See the blind man cheating at the word, the bullets flying. Lord, I bet you have you not been here? You've not been hit by flying yet. You'd better close your eyes. You'd better bow your head.
That's Deep Purple from the marvellous, marvellous Made in Japan, 1972, Ian Gillan screaming away. And before that, the song Child in Time, absolute classic, introduced to me by Nick Land, the father of accelerationism. It was him that first said, oh, you've got to have a listen to this Deep Purple, it's fantastic stuff. And of course, he's right. Not right about the Dark Enlightenment, though, I don't think. But anyway, also before that was Jesus I Have Promised and the choir of Guildford Cathedral. It sounds a very young choir of Guildford Cathedral. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner on the talkradio.org.uk stream and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. There's a link on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to a non-Google app store with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Right, drones, Martin, got to start here. This week we've seen this bizarre encounter between these Russian fighters, SU-27s, I think, and an American Reaper drone flying around the Black Sea next to Crimea. First of all, what are the Americans up to flying these drones around? I mean, I imagine they are the same as the other drones. They're based, they are actually run through a US air base in Ramstein in Germany, which was revealed by Glenn Greenwald many years ago. So the Germans are actually facilitating this US. I suppose they're used for intelligence gathering or something like that. And what's happened this week with this drone?
Well, the drone didn't go through Turkish airspace because I believe the Turks aren't allowing the Americans to use their airspace.
So it actually they can't use Interlink then?
No, they can't. No. So in other words, it flew over Bulgaria in order to get to where it got in the Black Sea. I'm not sure where it took off from. But of course, if the Russians were to fly a drone towards the Royal Navy's main base at Portsmouth, then it quite likely might get shot down, mightn't it? Or something would happen to it. And that's what's happened to this. It's actually in 800 metres of water. The Russians have now completely surrounded, they're on top of where that drone is.
So we've got these kind of James Bonds with their little submersibles going down
They've got a ship that was actually originally built in 1913, I was reading today. This is Simplicissimus, it's all really good stuff. And they're going to bring the drone up, and of course they're hoping that they can get all the specifications of the drone and everything that it was trying to find out.
So what is this website you've been reading about this on, and is it blocked by the wonderful Free World's Great Firewall?
It's called Simplicissimus, and you can contribute, but it is actually free.
What I'll do is I'll put a link up to the article on our show page.
I sent you the article. He's very knowledgeable. And of course, the real problem is that NATO have been providing all sorts of targeting information to the Ukrainians, which have led them to, you know, kill various Russian soldiers, you know, sink the Moskva, etc. And at a certain point, the Russians are just going to lose patience with that. I mean, you know, if your drone is passing information directly back to Ukrainian fire control, then it's in the war, and we're going to take it out. And of course, the other thing is that happened this week: Kinzhal missile attacks in Ukraine. It looks as if they may have actually hit a NATO command headquarters and killed up to 40 NATO officers because of the
that
war.
That was last week, wasn't it?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, and I think when they hit the Zaporizhia, which I was discussing last week, it looks to me as if it was the Ukrainians hitting that rather than the Russians.
Yes, but the Russians have just fired off a salvo of hypersonic missiles, and it may well be, up to now, they haven't targeted NATO command and control inside the Ukraine because they were trying to sort of, you know, we're going to try to keep NATO out of it or whatever. But I think they're reaching the point now where if NATO military personnel are in the Ukraine and aiding the Ukrainian war effort, then the Russians are just saying, well, we're going to kill them because there's no reason for us not to.
Will they kill them, do you think?
Well, what's being suggested in Simplicissimus is that they've already killed 40 NATO officers last week.
Why haven't we heard about any of that?
Because what's happening is the Russians do that. The West doesn't want to admit that they've got senior officers in command and control in the Ukraine, so they can't say anything about it. Although they did send a B-52 to try and threaten St. Petersburg, which then veered off. And they've done various other things, which show how unhappy they are with this, with what the Russians have done. But the Russians basically have for their own reasons, have not targeted NATO personnel, certainly senior personnel who are in the Ukraine. But of course they can, and now they have. And of course NATO haven't got nothing. NATO is not supposed to be there. So,
NATO aren't involved in this war.
No, that's right. Well, I mean, if they are there though, you've got a back channel. I mean, Austin phoned Shoigu to talk about this drone thing. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, if you are going to send a drone to spy on the, you know, the Crimea and Russia's top naval base, well, they're not going to allow that to happen, are they? Same as if the Russians sent a drone
shoot it
to
down.
Portsmouth.
Anyway,
no, they ran into it. Not that there's other things that they sprayed it with.
Before we go any further, let's have a listen to Scott Ritter. He does a brilliant chat with Judge Neapolitano from time to time, and so let's have a listen to Scott Ritter now talking about this very topic.
During the Cold War, during the time of Ronald Reagan, we flew the most sensitive reconnaissance missions all along the periphery of the Soviet Union. And on numerous occasions, the Soviets challenged us. You know, what would Ronald Reagan do? Hey, Graham, Lindsey Graham. How about the USS Charon in the Black Sea, 1988, and an American cruiser was coming too close to Crimean Peninsula. Imagine that. And what did the Russians do? They sent a ship out that rammed it to knock it off course, made physical contact. What are you going to do, Lindsey? Sink the Russian Navy, you idiot? No, this is what big boys do. You see, big boys play big boy games, and they understand the consequences of the big boy game. We pushed it too far. The Russians put down the drone. Big boys back off and go, lesson learned. Lindsey Graham, a little boy, wants to play tough guy. It ain't going to be him in the cockpit of the American aircraft. And I'll also tell you this, Lindsey, you don't have enough airplanes to put up and shoot down two Russian airplanes next to Crimea, because they got an air defense system that includes the S-400 missile. They'll shoot down everything you're bringing in at it. And what are you going to do now? Bomb the air defense systems? Then they bomb your airfields. Then what, Lindsey? We got a nuclear war. Is that what you want, Lindsey Graham? Everybody listening to Lindsey Graham should dismiss him immediately as a dilettante, an idiot, and a warmonger who only wants to get America in trouble. And if you take a look at his face, you'll understand. He's not going to be the one who's paying the price.
Here's his colleague and fellow neocon, Senator Marco Rubio.
I think our response should be to fly more of these in that area and to potentially have them escorted by U.S. fighter jets who are manned and have the capability to respond. These are unarmed platforms. They're generally out there for reconnaissance, to see what's happening in the ocean, to have a situational awareness of what's going on in the area, totally according to international law. And so I think we should fly more of them. We shouldn't stop flying them. And in many cases, we should be prepared to scramble jets and respond if they are threatened by Russian aircraft.
Again, the dumbest man in the world. Does he not understand, Marco, who's never served in the military? You want to take American military aircraft and fly them escorting a drone. Do you understand that the only advantages we have in air-to-air combat is long-distance engagement? You see, we don't do dogfights anymore, Marco. It doesn't work that way. We take off and at a long distance with AWACS aircraft vectoring us in. We fire missiles to engage them in a long distance. You want to take all that advantage away, come up close next to their battle space where their air defenses will shoot you down. Their aircraft don't have to come close. They'll shoot you long distance. You're an idiot. He doesn't know anything about war, and he doesn't know anything about international law. Pro hint, Marco, when you fly an intelligence asset, collecting intelligence on one target, and you provide that intelligence to the other side to kill that other target, you're a participant in the conflict. You lose all the protections you have. You should be thankful the Russians aren't shooting down everything we got.
Well, that's obvious, isn't it, really?
But it's not obvious to the mainstream press, who seem to think this is a terrible thing for the Russians, a very ungentlemanly and unprofessional way for them to behave.
Well, it's absurd because Baerbock, who's the German foreign minister, openly said, we are at war with Russia. Now, the Russians basically have snorted at that because they haven't, as Putin said, we haven't even started yet. But of course, if you are going to have a drone which is going to be spying on Russian forces in Crimea and elsewhere in the Ukraine, or now Russia, of course, as well, according to the Russians, then they are going, and it's going to lead to operational consequences for Russian soldiers who are going to be killed, etc. Then they're going to shoot it down, or they're going to get rid of it by whatever method. And of course, you can say, well, we're going to double down on that and send loads more drones. Well, the Russians will shoot them all down. And if you send a plane with a pilot in, they'll shoot it down with the pilot in and kill the pilot, if that's what you want. And then, of course, what are you going to do then?
Okay, so a little bit more from Scott on the drone incident.
One of the things that nations can do during times of conflict like this or crisis is to declare exclusionary zones. So normally you have a 12 nautical mile extension of your territorial limit. But what you can do is say, we're going to extend that for a period of time because of special national security reasons. We do it. Other nations do it. And Russia has done it. Basically telling the United States, don't bother flying your drone through this space or any aircraft through this space. Well, we opted to fly our drone through that space because we claim that Crimea doesn't belong to Russia. It belongs to Ukraine. And therefore, the territorial extension out of Ukraine belongs to Ukraine, and Russia doesn't get to impose its own exclusionary zone on that. You know, so we're playing semantic games. And on the surface of that, the Russians may not, in and of itself, on that choose to create a conflict. We know the British tried this with a ship back in the summer of 2021. I remember they sailed a destroyer right along the same path that the Reaper was on. At that time, the Russians fired warning shots, and when it was done, they told the British, if you ever sail here again, we'll sink the ship. No questions asked. We won't put up with it. Well, the British stopped sinking ships, or sending ships. We sent the drone, and Russia gave us instructions. Get out of here. 19 times they flew by it. 19 times. If you don't get the hint by the 19th time, then Russia gets to do things like dump fuel on the drone to break up its aerodynamics and bring it down. They didn't shoot it down, but they brought it down. But here's the question. Why? Was this just about a diplomatic spat? No. You see, the United States is in the business of using intelligence information collected on Russia, giving it to the Ukrainians so the Ukrainians can carry out attacks against Russia. So we are an active participant to the conflict. So the notion that we can come in and claim some sort of, you know, international freedom of navigation status, that we are purely an innocent party, is absurd in the extreme. We collect intelligence. On the left wing of that drone was one of the most sophisticated signals intelligence collection platforms available for that drone. It was actively collecting intelligence on, you know, against Russia to give to the Ukrainians so the Ukrainians could use it for war. We were a legitimate target of war. Russia should have shot us down out of the sky. The fact that they didn't means that Russia's in the business of escalation management, not trying to make this a big deal. But it is a big deal because the intelligence we provide to Ukrainians results in dead Russians and destroyed Russian equipment.
So the drone is an active participant in the war. The United States is an active participant in the war, but they're trying to make out, oh, it's just a little drone flying around, you know. Oh, the Russians are so mean.
Well, yes, and of course, what the Russians have done by not shooting it down, it's as I say, it's fallen into 800 meters of water, and they're going to recover it, mm. And of course, then they're going to reverse engineer everything to do with that drone. So it's a win-win for the Russians, lose-lose for the West.
Yeah, but it's a propaganda victory for the West, isn't it?
They're saying it's hardly a propaganda victory.
Yes,
is it?
But to say, well, I think that what they're saying is, oh, look at the Russians are very mean, but there's no counter argument whatsoever in the coverage of this. But by the way, I was hearing one of the government ministers today talking about wanting to have a no-fly zone over Ukraine, like we did in Libya.
Well, the problem with that is that the Libyan air defence had to be knocked out first, which was very destructive. And then, of course, they then bombed the Libyan armed forces to defeat from the air because they didn't have any air defence. You're not going to be able to do that to the Russians in the Black Sea, not least because the Turks won't allow you to bring more than a minimum number of ships into the Black Sea.
The other question has got to be, if fighter jets are going to escort the drone, are they going to be Bulgarian fighter jets, or are they going to be Polish, British, or American?
Well, that's a very good question, but as Scott Ritter pointed out there, they don't have to do any, they can shoot down this stuff from hundreds of kilometres away. So they don't have to come up and try and take over. You know, a drone is probably safer on its own than having an aeroplane with it. The aeroplane just adds an extra target for the Russians. Now, what they're doing here is they're playing chicken. And of course, if you play chicken, you can make the miscalculation. And at some point, the Russians, I'm not saying they're going to do this, I've no idea what their planning is. But if they suddenly decide to say, you know, that stuff about special military operation, it's over. We are at war with NATO, and the first thing we're going to do is drop a Kinzhal missile on Portsmouth and sink a load of ships.
Or Ramstein, where the drones are controlled from.
Or on Salisbury Plain, where you're training the Ukrainian commandos.
And I think one of the things that a chap called Henry was chatting to me about earlier this week was, I think, fascinating, which is the reason that the Russians have upped the ante in Ukraine and decided to invade is not just because the Ukrainian army was massing in February last year, ready in 2022, ready to actually invade the Donbass, and they preempted that by attacking the Ukrainian army. It's because of this American doctrine of nuclear primacy, this idea that the Americans basically can do a first strike with nuclear weapons. Now, this concept is, I mean, what they're saying is even something like if they get a cyber attack, which may have been done by their own side, then they can then start using nuclear weapons. The Russians are taking this very seriously as a threat to their own national existence.
Well, they are, and don't forget that the missile bases in Poland and Romania, which when they were put in, they said, they're no threat to Russia, they're just to protect Europe from the Iranians. And the Russians just thought that was rubbish. These missile bases in Poland and Romania are a direct threat of a first strike against the Russian Federation, where they could do a decapitation strike on Moscow, and then there wouldn't be a possibility of a, although they've got nuclear submarines, of course. I mean, people talking like this about having the nuclear war situation got a lot better after the Intermediate Forces Treaty, which Scott Ritter was one of the people who enforced, because you've just got intercontinental ballistic missiles in the US and in Russia. So if anyone does anything by accident, you've got about half an hour to decide what's happening. If you've got missiles in place, which you've got 5 minutes to hit Moscow, then the only answer to that to the Russians is to knock those out before it starts, yeah, or put missiles into Cuba. So that you're under a five-minute warning as well.
We do occasionally, on some channels like LBC and Andrew Moore, hear from the Russian ambassador to the UK, Andrei Kelin. And here he is talking to Andrew Moore this week about various things, including this idea of every time we give longer-range missiles to the Ukrainians, the Russians are going to have to fight further and take territory further into eastern Ukraine.
What we are seeing right now is that United States, as a part of the treaty, is becoming more and more adversarial. Its policy line is a strategic defeat on Russia. Strategic defeat, you can imagine that. And also it has been joined by France and Britain. In this line, they also would like to put strategic defeat in Russia. By the way, UK is increasing its nuclear arsenal by 40%, as we understand, number of the warheads on the nukes in the submarines. All of that.
We have very few compared to you. Very few.
Come on. They are saying that China also has a similar number, but the US is doing an effort to bring it into the negotiations. So all in all, it makes a fundamental change of circumstances, which lawyers are calling as a precondition to change the situation. Let me explain to you. What we are doing right now, we are suspending our participation in this treaty, which basically means that we are suspending verification procedures.
Mm. Yes.
Exchange of information.
Yes.
However, we are responsible participants. And the limits on the nuclear warhead will remain. We will stick to the limits that has been inscribed in the treaty. We also will continue the exchange about launches of missiles. So the main part of the body of the treaty will remain. And this is reversible.
Suspension should be reversed.
Yes.
Under what circumstances could it be reversed?
We shall better conditions. We will need to see that U.S. is reversing its policy of creating anti-Russia out of Ukraine, that it is coming back into the normal strategic situation. One of the fundamentals, by the way, it is link between offensive and defensive weapon. It is absolutely important. It has been from the very beginning of the strategic process, but U.S. has gone out of ABM treaty, which is, of course, one of the major preconditions of the stability here.
Is this the beginning of a wider world war between Russia and the West?
I hope, and I do not know, not at all, not this one step, but however, NATO countries are going deeper and deeper into the conflict, especially UK as a leading European country in this aspect by providing more
now, possibly. Hmm? There's a cause to provide fighter jets as well as new battle tanks.
Not sure, but the long-range weapon is the most dangerous here. The longer range of this weapon will be, the further we will have to push this line in Ukraine, because we need to safeguard Crimea and the main part of Russia. So if UK is provided longer range weapons, so we will need then to push this line further into Ukraine just to secure ourselves.
This seems to be the game that NATO is playing, Martin, is to make sure this war continues by supplying longer and longer range weapons to the Ukrainians. And they'll say, oh, we're not involved in this war at all.
Well, except the other side of their mouth, you've got the German foreign minister saying that we are at war with Russia.
So what is this whole idea?
Straight out and saying it.
Strategic defeat of Russia. Now, this is going to make nerves rattle in the Kremlin, isn't it? All over Russia.
Well,
actually.
I mean, but what they're saying is there is, on the one hand, they're saying, well, maybe we should negotiate, and we're only supporting the Ukrainians so that they can get a better deal at the negotiating table. Meanwhile, the former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson told them we're not negotiating
in
with
April
Russians.
2022.
Yes, they were not, in there April. Was already a negotiation in place and a discussion for a settlement based around the Minsk agreements of 2014 and 2015. The Chinese peace proposal, they made a big dum-dum-dum-dum, what's our peace proposal? Go back to the Minsk agreements of 2014-2015. But of course the Russians are not interested anymore in that because they don't trust the West to stick to what it's already agreed.
Upping the ante with China too this week with the deal signed with the French and the Australians to equip them with these nuclear-powered attack submarines.
Yeah, well, it's not the French. The French were excluded. It was their submarines.
Oh, sorry, yes, okay.
But what was interesting about that to me was that Paul Keating, the former Labour Prime Minister of Australia, was scathing about the whole thing. He said it was the worst deal in history.
Let's have a listen to him.
China does not threaten Australia, has not threatened Australia, does not intend to threaten Australia.
What makes you so sure China isn't a military threat to Australia?
Because I've got a brain, principally, and I can think, and I can read. You know, and I read every day, you know. I mean, why would China want a threat? What would be the point? I know you're trying to ask a question, but the question is so dumb it's hardly worth an answer. I'd say for the cost, $360 billion. For $360 billion, we're going to get 8 submarines. Right? This must be the worst deal in all history. China has committed, in the eyes of the United States, the great sin of internationalism. And what is that sin? To develop an economy as big as the United States. That's the sin. They will never, the Americans will never condone or accept a state as large as them, you know? And that's what China presents. China's mere presence. I mean, they would have preferred they remain in poverty, 20% of humanity forever. But the fact that China is now, you know, an industrial economy larger than the United States, larger, according to the IMF, 20% larger, they say, hang on, this is not in the playbook. This is not in the playbook. You know, what an affront. You know, this is what this is about.
So that's Paul Keating there, Martin, talking about the whole conflict. And, I mean, quite obviously, the Chinese are getting a bit annoyed, as well as the Russians, that the West seems to be trying to start World War III with them.
Yeah. And, of course, the Australians in particular ought to be thinking hard about this because their major trading partner is the Chinese. They managed to get their way through the 2008 crisis because the Chinese carried on buying their iron ore and coal and all the other materials that they supply.
Seems to think this is a great triumph of some sort. But actually, how does Australia get into the position where it's actually being drawn into a war with a superpower that it doesn't want or need?
Well, that's because you've got a comprador elite in Australia, and Albanese is a Labour Party Prime Minister, but he's obviously, Keating used to be the Prime Minister, and he's calling him out on this. You know, this isn't in the national interest of Australia. Australia needs, it's a relatively big country, but it's a small population. You know, all the other Asian countries are very unhappy about it. Indonesia, which is the biggest country, big population right near to Australia, they don't want the Australians to get involved in this. Nor do the New Zealanders have had a nuclear-free policy going back to the 1980s. Yeah. Let's just keep nuclear weapons out of the South Pacific, talk things down, not up,
so
and
these,
get on with, make, with
these
making,
Australian
making
leaders,
money.
These Australian leaders blackmailed or what?
Well, they are blackmailed in one way. I mean, Gough Whitlam took Australia out of the Vietnam War in 1972, and he wanted to get rid of Pine Gap, which was the equivalent of GCHQ in Australia. And, of course, he was overthrown by the Governor-General, John Kerr, acting on behalf of the Americans. So Australia is, in fact, a colony. It was a colony of Britain, and it's now a colony of the United States.
Well, it's also a colony of the companies we were hearing about earlier on, from Varoufakis, BlackRock, Vanguard, the rest.
Yes, I mean, that's who runs the West.
It is, pretty much, isn't it? But anyway, an investigation, our main investigation this week, is from Dr. Chris Busby. He has done, an amazing job on looking at the amounts of radiation in the air ever since this war in Ukraine started. And he's suspicious that it's because the West, not the Russians, is using depleted uranium munitions to blow up Russian tanks.
I was interested in 2006 about the radiation levels in England, which are measured by the Atomic Weapons Authority in Aldermaston. In the 1990s, there was a big leukemia cluster, in the 80s anyway, and in the 90s they looked at it, a leukemia cluster around the atomic weapons establishment at Aldermaston and Burfield, two sites near Reading. And there was a big childhood leukemia cluster there. I mean, I wrote about it and published something about it in the British Medical Journal in 96.
Sorry to interrupt you, but what do they do in those places?
They make the atomic bombs, and they make the nuclear weapons, and they make the depleted, I think they make the depleted uranium, but they certainly release an awful lot of uranium and plutonium. So that's where they constructed and developed the original nuclear weapons that were used at Christmas Island. And I do a lot of work with the nuclear test veterans on this issue, because those people are all getting cancer, and they've all got cancer. And so I've done a lot of court cases for those people. But atomic weapons establishment was at Aldermaston releases plutonium and uranium particles, and so they were forced in the 90s to set up filters at the plants themselves, but also 15 miles away from the plants, so that they could check to see whether any increases occurring were not global. So, you know, the idea was that if you get an increase of X at Aldermaston plant, and the same increase occurs, say, at Tilehurst or Basingstoke or whatever, where they used to have a filter. These filters pump air through a big filter paper, and then every 2 weeks they take the filter paper and they measure the amount of uranium on it or the amount of plutonium. Anyway, so in 2006 I had a look at those to see whether stuff was coming from the 2003 American war in the, you know, second Gulf War, and it was. And so that got into the Sunday Times, I think. So we had a big article in the Sunday Times on that, with a picture of the graph. So I thought recently, let's see what's happening in Ukraine, you know, because the point is there is all tank battles in Ukraine. And as the Americans showed in the Saddam War, depleted uranium is what kills tanks. Tank battles are impossible if you use depleted uranium. I went out to Iraq with Al Jazeera, and I looked at all the corpses of the tanks that had been hit by depleted uranium, and I measured the depleted uranium, and also in Kosovo too. I did that with Nippon Television. So I know all about the use of those weapons to kill tanks. They're absolutely deadly efficient. So I thought it was unlikely that they weren't being used in Ukraine. So I did a freedom of information request to the atomic weapons establishment, and they sent me all the numbers, and I looked at them. I plotted them all the different sites. There's nine air filters at different places around them. I plotted them all on one graph, and lo and behold, as soon as the war began in February 2022, up it went. And so if you it really quite large increases in uranium in the filters. So if you compare the war period with the non-war period, that would be from 2018 to 2022. That's quite a long period of time. So you get a big average there. And if you compare the average from the next 6 months, you can see that there's a statistically significant doubling in uranium in the air filters at Aldermaston. I mean, this is bad, because this means that the uranium in the air filters, of course, most of the uranium in the air filters is natural. But if you've got a sudden doubling during the war, it means that the amount that is suddenly appearing in those filters is coming from Ukraine, from somebody's use of uranium in Ukraine.
Well, anyway, a fascinating chat with Dr. Chris Busby about that and many other subjects to do with the Green Party's nuclear policy. Also, in how exactly these depleted uranium shells are so successful at destroying tanks. Martin, in another part of that interview, which I'll put the full version up on our show page tonight, in fact, I think it's even up on my BitChute channel now, is where he talks about the possible use of depleted uranium in these Javelin missiles, which are handheld anti-tank missiles. The depleted uranium could be being used in these Stinger and Javelin handheld missiles, which have been being shoveled into Ukraine by NATO right from the start.
Well, that would be a credible explanation of why it's happening. I understand that the Russian, I think Dmitry Peskov, who's the foreign minister, he was saying that if they are going to bring depleted uranium shells in, because he was saying it wasn't saying that it had happened yet. Well, we might consider that to be use of nuclear weapons, which then changes the attitude we're going to take towards what we're doing here. The javelins may have depleted uranium in them, I'm not sure, and that could be the explanation, but they've been singularly unsuccessful in terms of knocking tanks out, actually. It looks as if they're a busted flush.
From antiwar.com, 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers now have been killed in the war, including their most experienced fighters.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Western propaganda about how Ukraine is winning the war is absurd. And it's really just for Western consumption so that we carry on shoveling money and weaponry into this conflagration. It's just a totally irresponsible stuff.
Turkey has also announced that it plans to approve Finland's NATO bid before the country's May election. So that's before May. Now, it's making it clear that it's not going to approve Sweden because of the burning of the Quran in Sweden a few months ago. But Finland's in, apparently.
Well, I mean, all of these manoeuvres are going on a global scale. You know, we were just talking about Australia a minute ago. It's literally on the other side of the planet. And so the situation is very, very tense. It's the most tense it's been since World War II.
Well, this is why the Russians are getting a bit annoyed. Poland are now saying that they will become the first NATO members to supply Ukraine with fighter jets. Polish President Andrzej Duda, D-U-D, with an A on the end, Duda, said Thursday his country plans to give Kiev 4 Soviet-made MiG-29 fighters in the next coming days.
Well, all I say to that is, where are these MiG-29 fighters going to be based?
And all I've got to say,
if they're based in Ukraine, then the Russians will knock them out on the ground
that's right.
in Ukraine.
All I'm going to say
if they're based in Poland, they'll knock them out as they come over the border into the Ukraine, and then they may well hit the bases where they came from.
Isn't it going to be?
And we're only talking about 4 of them, so they make no difference whatsoever to the military balance on the ground. This is just the Polish president.
Whoever's flying those aircraft, they're going to be very brave Polish pilots.
Foolhardy.
Aren't they? We're going to hear a plonk.
That's right.
I mean,
all of this stuff about we're going to supply them with tanks and planes, it's too little, too late. It's got no military significance
at all.
Yeah, but
we keep hearing that Ukraine must win. Ukraine will win.
Well, that's just the usual, if we say it loud enough, we can make it true. But it's obviously not the case. It hasn't been the case from the get-go. And ultimately, the Russians will... I think the possibility of negotiated solution is slipping away because the Russian side have concluded, quite rightly, that there's no point doing deals with people who don't stick to what they've already agreed. So we're just going to do what we need to do here.
And we've had...
And that's all we're not going to tell you what that is. We're just going to get on with it.
In the last few hours, the International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin over alleged... Remember what I was saying earlier about alleged war crimes. Arrest warrants issued for Russian leader and his children's rights commissioner for unlawful deportation of all Ukrainian children. The International Criminal Court in The Hague issued an arrest warrant for Putin for overseeing the abduction of Ukrainian children.
Well, I don't know what that comes from. I mean, 1 million people from the Donbass have fled to Russia, and many of those will be children. But that's not kidnapping. That's people running away from NATO-supported aggression. Well, the International Criminal Court is an extremely flawed institution.
The International Criminal Court doesn't seem to bother about the use of depleted uranium weapons. That is to say, weapons of mass destruction spreading radiation all around in order to poison your crops into the indefinite future, for example, does it?
Well, I think the United States would have more credibility if they were themselves participants in the International Criminal Court, which they are not. They refused to participate in it. And, of course, the International Criminal Court did, in fact, indict quite a lot of people from former Yugoslavia, where I used to be an aid worker, you know, Croatians, Serbs, obviously, and some Kosovans were all indicted, and there was an attempt to even-handedness. The idea that they can accuse Putin of being a war criminal, Zelensky isn't a war criminal. I mean, he's killed loads of people, Zelensky. There's loads of people who died in prison. The SBU shot dead Kiriv, who was a negotiator with the Russians at the beginning of the crisis. Shot him dead, shot him in the head. That's a war crime. Loads of people have been killed by the SBU in Ukraine. Quite possibly the massacre at Bucha was carried out by the Ukrainian SBU. And of course, if this was Yugoslavia, we'd be saying, well, actually, this is quite, you know, there's probably war crimes being committed on all sides here. But, and if the International Criminal Court means anything, it's got to be impartial.
But
if it's not impartial, don't forget the Russians haven't signed up to the International Criminal Court either. Neither the Russians or the Americans are part of that court system.
There's no legal basis. It's also blamed the Russians for the taking down of MH17 aircraft too. The International Criminal Court seems a tool of NATO. On the subject of NATO, which is based in that massive SS building. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the pictures of that, Martin. Have you? It's got these giant SS
shape.
The shape of the two, not just the letters S and S, but the Zig runes that the SS used, which if you look at the NATO headquarters in Brussels from above, that's what you get. You get SS. In fact, you get two SSs. I had a threat to take down my video, which looks at the Dutroux scandal, which of course was in the centre of the European Union and NATO, Brussels. So I'll put a link up to the video of that. Please do download it and actually download the MP4 and spread that around if you can, because it's a very important BBC correspondent documentary from 2002 made by Alenka Frankel, which exposes this hideous paedophile murder ring going on in Brussels and the Dutroux scandal, which saw the biggest demonstrations that they've ever been in Belgium back at that time. And the idea that you've got a paedophile ring going on in the headquarters of NATO and the European Union is a little bit concerning, but apparently, no, YouTube say that we're not allowed to know about that. We're going to have to remove it from the internet, which I've had to do, otherwise I get some sort of copyright strike or something. Our final item this evening is because, now, you know, Martin, I know you don't like my sort of occult section, which I have at the end of this programme, but I can tell you, looking at last week's download figures, the interview with David Livingstone was by far the most downloaded copy. Maybe because we didn't have Scott Ritter last week, we'll see this week whether we get more downloads of David Livingstone or Scott Ritter. Actually, no, this is last week, so we won't be having this up on this week's show. But I think there's definitely an interest out there for this. And so our final item tonight, we can say goodbye to Martin now. Just for a few minutes, we're going to hear David Livingstone talking about nihilism and how that fits in with the secret power behind the scenes, the deep state here in the West.
To understand Satanism, we have to understand that Satanism is a kind of evil. Right? Evil exists before Satan. Evil is basically a rejection of good. Right? So it's evil is nihilism. Nihilism, basically, so the idea that there is no governing good behind the creation of the universe, everything is just chaotic. So this is why nihilism has been a very important influence or manifestation of this belief system. You can only understand Satanism if you understand nihilism. And nihilism, so basically, is the idea that if there is no God, then there is no truth, right? The universe is just black. There is no zero consequence for your actions. Nothing matters. So you could kill a child. It doesn't matter. There are no consequences. And this is where
it's almost like they're saying that the fact that, you know, most people think there are is just the big lie and they've seen through it.
Exactly. So this is how they view their own superiority. Right, they view themselves in a Nietzschean sense that they are Übermensch because they are able to what Nietzsche called achieve positive nihilism. Right, so this is why so even though we're living in this post-God era, 98% of people who have been sucked into it have not come to terms with what it means. And if there's no God, there is no truth. And so most people have rationalized that, oh, you know, that's why we have now ethics instead of, you know, the Bible and morals. But they haven't come to terms with the fact that, no, you cannot justify morality without the existence of a supreme being. So they see themselves as having the courage to do that. And so this is why. And this is nothing new. And you find this same thinking, nihilist thinking, going all the way back to the Gnostics and, of course, going back to the worship of Moloch in ancient times. Right? This is a propensity. This is the ultimate question that every human being, regardless of the existence, regardless of their knowledge of the Bible or Satan, it's a fundamental question that every human being is poised to ask himself, is what am I here for? Is there a purpose to my existence or not? And if some choose to not recognize the evident existence of some kind of good creator, they will choose, typically out of arrogance, that everything is here by accident. And if they do, they choose to believe that there is no such thing as morality. So what's important now is to recognize that not only is there no morality, but like Nietzsche said, all that's left is the triumph of the will, right? All that's left is the advancement of your own good. And that can be at the expense of the others, especially if they are weak, quote unquote, if they're unable to recognize this positive nihilism. So if you go back to the Gnostics, they also believe that God was a bad God, right? God imposed all these rules that suppressed our natural instincts, as they like to refer to them, right? So he suppressed incense, he suppressed adultery, he suppressed thievery, he suppressed murder. He basically prevented you from doing anything you want. And in their mind, you should be able to do everything you want. So in a way of for them to actualize this nihilistic belief system, they believe they have to overturn and sometimes do evil just for the sake of evil, just as a way of proving their disbelief. This is why you look at the early Gnostic rituals, and they have to do with eating feces and swallowing urine and menstrual fluid, you know, murder and adultery and all these things as open acts of defiance, as a ways of sort of demonstrating and proving their doing the defiance.
The fact that we've got these people, I mean, certainly, you know, this things seem to be going their way. It's rather concerning that part of their philosophy, this nihilist philosophy, but I mean, it's actually becoming kind of more organized and getting a bit of false multiplication, which is a bit concerning. That they like the idea that through the media, through government, through other forms of influence, maybe even through universities and things like that, that if they can actually get people to be the to actually destroy themselves, to be the instruments of their own demise, and that for them is a triumph. If people are doing things which are actually destructive to themselves, right, and the cult part of the culture becomes self-destructive. I mean, that sounds quite concerning if these sorts of people are. And you were saying earlier on that that one of their objects is to basically to infiltrate positions of power too.
Yes. Yeah. So basically, this is why my book is called Ordo Ab Caelo, which order out of chaos. Right? They believe that they need to sow chaos to bring about.
It just sounds like all chaos and no order.
Yeah, but you got to put they're Satanists, right? They don't believe in order. They believe in the absence of order. They believe only in the triumph of the will and survival of the fittest. They're not looking for a world order where they're going to enforce, you know, order and then everything's going to be hunky-dory. They're looking for an order that they will establish and remove morality.
So that's David Livingston there speaking to me last week. Terrific, I think, brilliant exposure of the satanic occult forces behind the scenes. Somebody, I think, commented on Twitter maybe about our show, Geopolitics and the Occult, and I think that absolutely does sum it up. And these things are intertwined. I mean, these groups, as David explains there, are deliberately infiltrating the criminal justice system, the political system, the business system, the banks, and that's what we're having to deal with, is basically secret societies. That's the way I see it. These cults effectively getting into these powerful positions in order to pursue their goals. So time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to Heidi Gedge and Elle Williams in the first hour, talking about some of the Kill the Bill riots, and also the youth service here in Bristol and the way that's being dismantled by the mayor and by the central government, and the central government effectively with the mayor being the local enforcer, a bit like the Americans enforcer Albanese over in Australia. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll find the podcast full length interviews, story links, and comment page, and our email addresses, and particularly regularly this week, the interview with Chris Busby, Dr. Chris Busby. I may play another clip from that next week. It's absolutely fascinating, particularly on the way that the Guardian columnist, who I worked with for a while back in the 1990s, a couple of years, in and out of his house every few days, George Monbiot destroyed him, literally character assassinated him, and then made sure that his funding was all taken away, and then came out as pro-nuclear. So that's a fascinating part of the discussion with Dr. Chris Busby, and he also looks at the position of the Green Party when it comes to nuclear, which is the Green Party being slowly but surely yanked away from its anti-nuclear position to become pro-nuclear. So you can subscribe to my weekly email list at thisweekoneword.org.uk, and my paperbacks, firstly about deals with the Allies and the Nazis at the end of World War II. That book's The Traitors of Arnhem. That's £15. Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergers looked at there as well, and the link between this battle in the Second World War and the creation of the Bilderbergers, coming up in Lisbon this May, which I hope very much to be commenting on, inshallah. And also the other book is called The Siege of Heaven Reader, both on eBay. And you'll find all the links to these, including the Siege of Heaven book itself, which is only an eBook. Links to all these from www.bilderberg.org. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream here, and over Sunday breakfast at Camberley's Radio Q UK.com. Do please feel free to make live recordings as well. We've been streaming from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at Radio Q UK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Thanks very much to them. And apparently being re-uploaded now onto Apple Podcasts. So also live on the glorious Not the BCFM Politics Show apps, and loads of different ways you can have a listen if you missed the live stream. If you can restream this live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Please also do download that De True documentary that YouTube are pulling in a rather sneaky and underhand fashion. So that you can make sure that you share that and you've got copies of it, and you're sharing it around various file sharing systems or whatever you've got, because it's a massively important film and it shows you the paedophile ring at the heart of NATO, the paedophile ring at the heart of the European Union, which obviously is something that they don't want people to know about. A bit of history they're trying to erase in their Orwellian fashion. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream, and the on the app, and at talkradio.org.uk at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the AutoAb KO banksters get you down.